There you go.
Okay. Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the December 18th, 2017 meeting of Chelan Public Utility District. This morning we're meeting in a study session, this afternoon in a business session. I'd like to welcome everybody here to the meeting and just a little reminder. Well, first, all the commissioners are here. Kelly Boyd is filling in for Steve Wright, and Rebecca Garfine and Eric Walquist are both here, our normal staff. And like to remind everybody that these meetings are all recorded, and if you wish to address any item on the agenda or the commission, please come to the table and use the microphone at the table and give us your name and address for the record, since they are recorded. And also would like to ask everybody to make sure they check their cell phones to make sure they're in the off or the silent position. That helps in the conduct of the meeting. And we will start this morning's meeting, as we always do, with the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute, brought to us this morning by Andrew Grissell.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. Andrew Grissell, Manager, Energy Development and Conservation here at Chelan PUD. And I'm bringing the safety minute today. And this might have been a little more useful a few weeks ago, but I'm going to talk about it anyways. And the holidays are supposed to be a time of joy, celebration, relaxation with family and friends. However, it's also one of the most stressful times of the year. And especially when you have kids with a countdown advent calendar that keep telling you every single day to get done what you need to get done. And we all know the causes. There's too little time, you know, your budget, did you stick to it? Trying to do too much, you know, being everything to everybody, as well as maybe there's awkward family interactions. You know, I have some of those with some extended family. I know it's not me. You know, I try to be the good, bigger person about that, and which is easy to do too. So why is this important? Stress and chemicals are produced in our brain, and that impacts all of our systems in the body when we're stressed. We got our fight or flight mechanism, which, you know, just like the Force, because of Star Wars, there's a dark side and a light side. The light side is with the, you know, when you're stressed out, your fight or flight mechanism gets you out of the situation when you need to get out of there. However, there's a bad side to it, that if it's continuous and constant over a period of time, you know, it leads to all sorts of issues. You know, it impacts every single one of your of our systems in our body. Nervous system, your memory, it'll impact whether or not you're remembering things. Your musculoskeletal system, say that fast a few times. You know, your muscles tense, you get migraines, you get headaches, you know, all those sorts of things. Your respiratory system, you know, it causes rapid breathing. Some people hyperventilating, and even for a smaller number of people, you get like panic attacks. And then cardiovascular system, your heart beats faster, your stress hormones also negatively impact the heart and can cause inflammation of the coronary arteries. So if you keep that up over a long period of time, not good for you. And then your endocrine system, your liver, all those sorts of things, it causes all sorts of issues with releasing of glucose at the wrong times and creates problems with the body. And then finally, your gastrointestinal, that knot in your stomach when you get stressed, heartburn, all those sorts of things. So what can be done? Well, you Google how to release stress, and there's 9,000 things. So I'm not going to read all 9,000 that I found. But what I thought I'd do is that we can take some of our planning and project management skills we use here at work and take it home. So before the season starts, you know, we have a plan. You decide what you are, and most important, even more importantly, what you're not going to do. You know, yes, I'm going to go to every single one of my kids' plays that we have, and there's a lot of them. but no, I may skip a party this year, and I may do it next year, or swap back and forth. So it's not such a time sink. You know, I'm going to develop a schedule and put it on paper. You know, we're pretty old-fashioned. I've still got a big, huge calendar on the wall that we write everything into as soon as we get notes home. And then create a budget, or at least a good estimate of what you're going to spend. You know, sometimes it's hard to keep right on that budget when you see that have-to-have thing. And then for the awkward family interactions, you know, just be kind and focus on what you have in common. You know, you're there to have a good time. You're there to be celebrating, you know, depending on, you know, what holiday you're celebrating. You know, you're there for a different reason than just, you know, trying to, you know, rehash something that might have happened in the past. And then last and most importantly, take a step back, breathe, and focus on what's really important. You're there for your family, you're there for your friends, know, for us, we're there with our faith and all those things brought together. You know, have a happy holidays and Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
Andrew, thank you. That was great. Well done.
Very well done. A lot of times we forget about the mental health side of our health and safety, and that's good. All right, commissioners, we have an agenda before us. There's been a staff recommendation of moving resolutions 13 and 15 to the consent agenda. Is there any opposition to moving those two resolutions? Hearing none, we will consider them moved to the consent agenda. Additionally, if there's anybody that wishes to have anything placed on the agenda, this is the appropriate time to make that request to the commission. No guarantees, but it is the time to make that request. Seeing nobody jumping to the microphone, I think we will move right on to item three, pre-legislative update.
I'd like to welcome Tracy Yent and Dave Arbaugh.
Good morning. And Andrew, thank you. I was wondering why I was so nervous and I have no idea what I'm up here to talk about. Dave, take over. I'm hoping it's so good. State legislative overview. You know, one thing I really appreciate is down in office services, they're making these presentations look a lot better than when I would do it myself. Getting some nice pictures up here. So Sean Seaman would be here, but he sent me a note this morning and is sick. And he would be here if he could be. So Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs, and Dave Arbaugh, our contract lobbyist in Olympia, are going to fill in for Sean this morning. So we're going to hit a couple of the major policy issues that we expect to see this legislative session, some changes that have occurred since last year, and then we'll get into some specific issues, and no decisions need to be made today. Energy, specifically related to carbon, is going to be another big issue this year, and I would expect it to be an issue for years to come, and we're going to dig into that just a little bit. Some water, telecom, governance and operations, and budget, human resources, some of our typical topical policy areas that we expect to see. So Dave's going to get into some of the overview and some of the changes that we've been seeing here on this next slide, and then we'll get back into some of the specific issues.
Right. Good morning. It's great to be over here in the crisp weather.
It warmed up this morning.
It's helping my cold. As you probably know, in the second Monday of January, every year the legislature returns to Olympia for another exciting adventure of legislative session. This year we anticipate a 60-day session. Begins the 8th of January. I think it really will be a 60-day session. You'll recall that earlier this year they went into several overtimes. But I don't think that's going to happen this time because although McCleary is not completely resolved, anything the legislature does in 2018, they probably can't implement a revenue policy to generate money that jives with school schedules in September. So it's going to be another thinking, planning year. They remain out, or they remain in contempt of court. They're going to have to return to the education funding topic, but I don't anticipate it's going to be in the 2018 legislative session. I think it's going to be sometime, they're going to continue discussions about it in 2018 and probably make another run at trying to resolve some of those things in 2019. There's also a considerable amount of legislative fatigue, as you can imagine, from three overtime sessions. And although many of us don't have a lot of sympathy for the fact that these overtime sessions have been occurring, it takes its toll on those folks that have been there and are trying to serve and doing the best that they can. So long answer, but short session should be short this year, in fact. Yeah, let's flip to the next slide. Thing. In the Senate, there's a lot of change going on. I don't think it's new news that the majority flipped in the Senate, so we now have a razor-thin majority in favor of the Democrats rather than the Republicans. There are 25 Democrats and 24 Republicans now, so that means that there's a new majority leader, so new leadership running the Senate. The Democratic Party is sort of setting the agenda for the Senate. Because they're in the majority, all the chairs of policy committees are Democrats, and that means that they will make decisions about what bills are heard, what bills are moved out of committee, and that's going to change the look of what's on the floor calendar when bills get that far. What isn't going to change is the fact that on controversial or difficult policy decisions, there's still just a razor-thin majority of one party over the other. And so on issues where there isn't a clear partisan lock on the thinking, it's going to be hard for the legislature to address some of those kinds of topics. I'll touch on this in a minute, but I expect an example of one of those kinds of topics might be carbon pricing. The key committees that we pay attention to in the Senate are the Senate Energy, Environment, and Technology Committee. This used to be Energy, Environment, and Telecommunications Committee, but with the new majority, they've changed the name of the committee. The chair of that committee is Reuben Carlisle. He's a senator from Seattle. He was one of the two champions of the cities and the PUDs in last year's telecommunications struggles with the legislation introduced at the behest of the wireless industry. He's also a very energetic, sort of data-driven individual. So we will learn quickly, if we don't know it already, that when we go in to talk to him about something, we need to have facts and figures and numbers and information to back up any assertions we're making. Government Operations and Security Committee is another committee we pay attention to. This is a committee that where most of the governance issues tend to go. The Senate also has had a local government committee in the past, and I think there is still some consideration about whether they should continue the Senate local government committee or not. And then Ways and Means, for obvious reasons, that's money. In the House, the policy committees we pay attention to remain technology and economic development. Chairman is Representative Morris. The local government committee, the chairman is Sherry Appleton from Kitsap County. The environment committee will be big this year in carbon discussions. The chair is Joe Fitzgibbon. Capital budget committee is one of the cluster of committees that deals with fiscal issues in the House. They organize it differently. Steve Theringer from Port Angeles area. And then Ag and Natural Resources, and that's Brian Blake. He's the 19th down on the West Coast, near Longview, a little bit west of Longview. There are a number of issues we watch. PUDs are somewhat unique in terms of our scope. We're public agencies. We're large employers, we're utilities, and we're local governments. So the scope of each of those topic areas gets broader and broader. So we tend to watch just about everything that's going on in Olympia, unless it's, you know, education policy. And even now we're paying attention to that because of the funding issues. When we get there, the legislature's first job is to approve a supplemental operating budget. That's really the only thing they probably have to do this year. There's a note on here about education funding. I mentioned that earlier. I don't really anticipate that they're going to get into that much in the 2018 session. The capital budget, as you know, was not approved last session. The Senate majority at that time had tied it to a water law decision from the Supreme Court, commonly known as Hearst, the Hearst decision. And Hearst doesn't really have anything to do with the capital budget other than it's a political link that the majority coalition made in order to assure that the Hearst decision would be dealt with. The discussions have continued throughout the interim on Hearst, and there's been no agreement or compromise. The election happened, the parties, the majority shifted in the Senate. There is some thought that if the Democrats produce a, who control both chambers and the governor's office now, produce a bill that they view as a reasonable attempt to address Hearst issues, that maybe they can push a Hearst bill through the Senate and the House and down to the governor. If they're able to do that, that could have the effect of sort of delinking the capital budget from the water issue, and then maybe the capital budget could be freed up and could move. The catch with the capital budget, even though the Democrats have the majority now, is that it requires a bond bill to fund, and the bond bill takes a 60% majority to approve. So the 25-vote majority that the Senate Democrats have is not sufficient to meet that 60% threshold. I'm going to skip over carbon pricing for a moment and get down to retail telecom authority. There, as has been the case the last few years, there's a lot going on with telecommunications for PUDs. This session, we expect the association to have their retail authority bill again. This is something they've introduced the last several years running. This year also, we anticipate legislation that would authorize Kitsap PUD only to have retail authority. This is a bill that the Kitsap utility has been interested in and is working on, has worked on for some months, I understand. We just received a draft of it. We're going through it now. So I'm sure that that will have implications in the legislature, potentially within the PUD community as well. I'm not sure what all those are yet. Representative Morris continues to be interested in distributed energy planning, which is a requirement that utilities conduct more planning on a 10-year cycle. The city of Seattle continues to be interested in legislation which would authorize municipal utilities or public agency utilities to offer incentives for electric vehicle use. And that's been somewhat controversial because we don't want to get into a discussion in the legislature where we think we already have that authority. There's some division of opinion among the public agency utilities about how to write this thing. So it's been a fairly carefully crafted bill, and we'll be seeing Seattle make another run at that in the next couple of months. An update on bid limit amounts is coming, and then poll attachments, which includes is related to the telecom issues, but I don't know what to say about that, except that the wireless industry continues to want PUDs to lower their poll attachment rates. Not all PUDs, and it isn't just the wireless industry, it's the cable industry as well. So we'll be working on that again as usual. So I guess the theme I should have pointed out at the beginning is that we're just going to kind of keep going where we were. We just are, it's the same basic list of issues we worked on through the regular session, and we're going to continue to work on them now, with a little more focus on some of the carbon pricing things. And so that's where I'm going to turn it over for Tracy to say something while I catch my breath.
Any questions for Dave before we go over to carbon?
Dave, does the state still have to pay fines on regarding the school funding?
Yes, the fine situation has not changed. As you probably are aware, there's some dispute as to whether ultimately they're going to have to write a check to themselves or not. But yes, there's nothing changed with respect to the contempt order.
So any other questions on those items? So on the carbon front, we do expect to see some proposals, not only from legislators, but also, just like the governor signaled, going to be introducing something after Christmas, carbon tax. And he signaled that a portion of the revenues would be moving into paying for education. So we don't have any words on this, anything in writing, but it's a signal early that this is going to be another 60-day push on carbon. There are also NGOs that we've been talking with who are very interested in carbon-related legislation, and we've heard different options and different ideas. Again, we will have to be ready to react when we see words on paper. One of our objectives has been, over the last several months, is to gather information. Like Reuven Carlisle is a numbers person. Well, thankfully, this is a time where the utility industry has really spent a great deal of effort gathering information to assess what the implications are of carbon pricing. So we've been working with Public Generating Pool. We've been working with the PUD Association trying to get a common starting point for engaging on carbon. And we expect these proposals to be coming at us. And one of the nice things that we have now is at least a common starting position with these two associations. So when we start to see the detail, we can at least get into and understand what the implications are a little bit more. There will be a lot of activity on carbon this year. If legislation does not pass, and it's going to be tough to pass legislation, I've heard people, Dave has guaranteed these numbers between 0 and 30% likelihood. of passing, but it's kind of one of those rocket ships. You know, it's I think you came up with this analogy. If you're on the ship when it starts, okay, you're going along with it and you're part of it. But if you're not on that ship when it takes off, there's no catching up to it. So we've been trying to be talking with folks, engage with folks on the carbon issues, so that we can where we have the opportunity provide our perspectives. So if something doesn't pass, there is a very high likelihood of an initiative being introduced, or one or more. And polling numbers would suggest that an initiative has would likely pass. But we'll just have to see. I mean, those are numbers people share with you. And I guess the thing to be confident of is we will see proposals, and if something doesn't pass, we'll likely see an initiative.
Can I add a quick thing?
You may.
On carbon, I had a long conversation with the new vice chair of the Senate Energy Committee, a guy named Guy Palumbo from the 1st District, and straddling the King and Snohomish County line. And he was included in a group of legislators that was briefed on the PGP work, and told me he's very excited about that, thrilled that the public utilities, at least with those involved with the PGP effort, are doing this, and wants us to work with him. He's been assigned by Carlisle to be lead on the carbon issues. And he's going to make a serious attempt to get something through the legislature this year. And he knows the odds as well as we do. But if it's possible, there is a real preference to get something accomplished legislatively. I don't think anybody really relishes the idea of spending all of the money it will take to get an initiative passed. So the message is kudos to the utilities that have been participating in that funding effort. It's really been helpful already.
Commissioner Congdon.
Thanks for
Tracy, NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Who are some of those organizations you think of off the top of your head?
Climate Solutions, Renewable Northwest, Nature Conservancy.
Energy Coalition.
Nature Conservancy, I'm going to get this wrong, but Nature Conservancy, I heard the numbers. They're big. They're like worldwide. They're really a substantial organization, and they are involved in this subject now. They've become more active, and they're used to initiatives. I think the number was they ran across the U.S. 18 initiatives last year. 17 passed, so they have a track record of knowing what it takes and then passing an initiative, and they're central in the carbon discussions right now. Rough numbers, but I think that gives you the flavor for the type of organization they are.
And they also work very closely with the legislature. They do a lot of work on the capital budget in getting projects up and running, acquiring land and land use projects. They're well regarded on both sides of the aisle, and to see this issue with such enthusiasm is a sign that things are starting to move, either legislatively or financially.
This may be a total aside, but this morning I read in the energy section of the Washington Post a little article about utility scale solar being installed on Bureau of Land Management land, either Nevada or Arizona. I don't remember the state off the top of my head. But what caught my eye was this utility scale solar, which was covering 2,000 acres of BLM land, would provide enough electricity when it was generating, which is during the daylight hours, to serve Chelan County, 46,000 homes. So 2,000 acres of solar to cover what 1/4 of Rocky Reach Dam covers. So, I mean, that I was thinking about Representative Carlisle and a data point. That might be a good data point to have because that's, you know, when you talk about spoiling the land, 2,000 acres for a small segment.
Yeah, I'll pull that up and take a look and put it in our pocket for when we're talking.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, from a Chelan County perspective, that speaks volumes. And you still have to have backup power.
Yeah, that's when the sun shines.
Yeah. It's a 30% deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that's about the, if the math is correct in my head, it usually isn't, but about the same capacity as the Chelan project.
Yeah.
2,000 acres.
Actually, it's I think Chelan's a little smaller than that.
It is.
So, anyway, it's going to be another exciting year in Olympia. Yeah. You think they'll be going home in early March then?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's another reason for that because they have to fundraise.
Yeah, that's true too. That's true.
All right.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Item 4 is Arundo River Park.
I'd like to welcome Michelle Smith and Jeff Smith.
Good morning, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services. And Michelle Smith, Director of Hydro Licensing and Compliance.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sorry for paying attention.
We would also like to introduce Ron Crittlebaugh in the audience. He's the Douglas County Port District Economic Development Manager, standing in for Lisa Parks today, the Executive Director. Ron, welcome. Glad to have you here.
Welcome.
Our topic today is the future operation of Arundo River Park. You may recall we were here back October 16th to open a dialogue about future operation of that park. We're back today with a whole lot of new information that's been generated since. Just a quick reminder about the park, directing your eyes to the board over there. It's a 5-acre site, 3.6 acres owned by the Port District, 1.4 acres owned by the PUD. And the park is operated by the Poor District under terms of a 1979 lease and operating agreement with the PUD. The park is part of the PUD's recreation plan for the Rocky Reach federal license. And with that, we'll turn it over to Michelle.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. Good morning, Commissioners. I just wanted to briefly go over what we are planning to share with you today. Just a reminder again, no action is being requested today, no decisions. We really wanted to come back after the October presentation and just give you some more information as we've been learning it about Arondo and as we've been talking and working with the Port of Douglas County as well as the public survey information. And so today we wanted to share some more information going through some of the alternatives we've been exploring and as well as the costs associated with those alternatives. We also wanted to let you know that we have looked more at the land ownership considerations, and I want to dive a little bit more into that with you today. We want to go through a staff recommendation for an interim operating plan in 2018. We're realizing that it's going to take us a little bit to make some decisions about the park, and so wanted to share with you the plan for 2018 as we've been working with the port on that. And then go through a little bit high level of the public survey information, and then also next steps in the schedule for that. So I go over this at the end, but I brought it forward also just so that as we're presenting this information, you have this up front, that we're planning to come back early January to get your input and hopefully approval for the interim 2018 plan. We want to do a couple of assessments, both a condition assessment of the park as well as an environmental assessment, which we have planned for early 2018, and bring that information back to you before we ask you to make a final decision on the future operating and maintenance plan for the park and the land ownership alternative. So we felt like we just couldn't bring back all of that information for you now that could lead to a final decision. So we wanted to take a little more time. So in early January, we just will be coming back with an interim operation plan for 2018. And I'll go through that a little bit more in the presentation. Some background information. 14 parks is in our license for Lake Chelan, Rocky Reach, and Rock Island licenses. We total about 800 acres of park lands, 12 boat launches, 324 RV and tent campsites, 12 sports fields, 17 miles of trail, and we have about 3.5 million visitors per year. Our parks are well used, as you know. And this often surprises people, but just for the parks that the PUD manages, we spend close to $5 million per year operating and maintaining those parks. So that includes capital and expenditures, but its parks are very expensive to operate and maintain. On the right-hand side, I did put in there, just so you can get a sense of relative size of our parks and who they are managed by, sometimes helps to kind of divide them up in your mind that way. And I should mention, if you have any questions as I'm going through this, feel free to ask them. Some facts about Arondo River Park. Has been our license since 1976. The Douglas Port of Douglas County has managed that park since 1972. As Jeff pointed out in the map, we have about 2 acres that are contributing to the park, and the port owns about 3 acres. Very important to the discussion is the fact that the port has received grant funding for most of the amenities in that park. We've listed them there. And because they have received state grant funding, that obligates them in perpetuity to recreation at that park. So as we've been learning more about that obligation, that will is becoming more and more important in the decision making, because the land value with the land that the port owns will always be encumbered with a recreation component in there. So in terms of the port being able to sell that property, it would be very difficult because it stays encumbered with the recreation component in perpetuity.
Wow.
Some existing park amenities. I won't go through all of these. I did put an asterisk next to the items that were funded with grant funding. So that's about the first half of the bullet list there. And then the importantly, the camping has not been grant funded. Basically, it's pretty self-explanatory there. The gazebo and a lot of the lawn area is on Chelan PUD property.
Michelle, could you help me a second? On the first one, the moorage, day use and overnight. What is the overnight referring to?
So currently there is overnight moorage at the facility. It is fee-based. So again, the reason that Arundel's been able to go on this long is because it's a fee-based park. So the revenues from the overnight moorage, overnight camping, has been largely the income and the revenue that's been supporting that park.
Okay, so, and maybe it's too early for questions, but if this park was converted to a day use only, how does it affect that clause for the overnight moorage?
So the day use would be removal of anything overnight, so both the moorage, overnight moorage, and the overnight camping.
Okay.
It would be day use only closed at
dusk. So that could then be removed.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
That's correct. Just a reminder on this slide of what the port is asking. They would like us to take over the operation and maintenance of the park. They've also offered to transfer the land ownership to us, the 3 acres that they own. Some considerations here. The port, they have a limited staff of 4 people. They are not in the park business, and this is not the first time the port has asked the PUD for some help. I can go back in decades of my folders and find where they have asked for support over the years. And it's a huge obligation for them. They've been struggling with it. And as you know, in October, Lisa Parks was here and said we would really like the PUD to help. We have an obligation in our license to that park. It goes through the license term, 2052. And we also know that we need to know more. We need to learn more about the park. So in order to come back and give you a little more confidence around our numbers and what we think needs to be done in that park, we are recommending an environmental and a condition assessment during January, February, March of next year so we can bring that information back to you. The 4 alternatives that we've been talking about and discussing is, I'm going to go through them generally here, and then I have a detailed chart that's next. So the first alternative is more of a partnership that has to do more with the status quo option that we were talking about in October. Really, this would just financially supporting the port more than we have been doing in the past. It would be the least change to the park, basically just keeping the camping, but providing more funding, both in the O&M side. We're looking at this as no ownership change at this point with this alternative. Well, with all 4 alternatives, I should say. The second one is different, the second alternative, and that this is the PUD really taking more control. So the port would back out. We would be totally have control of the operation and maintenance of the park. The same with alternative 3 and 4 in terms of the PUD control. However, in alternatives 3 and 4, we would be taking away the overnight amenities. So this would be no camping. Alternative 3, we were trying to come up with a least cost alternative by maybe taking away some of the costly features of even the day use, which is keeping the lawn green, trying to keep all of the landscape the way it is. But we're finding that the costs aren't really that different. If you try to take it back to its natural state, because you still have maintenance regardless. You have to keep weeds out. You still have to maintain if you put trails in there. So really what we're looking at is just a different experience. So we could have a day use experience that's a little more some natural trails, some access to the water, but take away the big grass lawn area that is fairly water intensive to keep up. and make that alternative four. So we could keep that lawn area as day use, but we separated the two different park atmospheres, I guess, if you will, in three and four.
Now, Michelle, for clarification on alternative one versus alternative two, alternative one, the port would still be responsible for staff to maintain the park. Alternative two, that staff obligation would go to the PUD.
That's correct. Or we contract that out. So in either case, there's the option of either the port contracting it out in option one, or number two, we take control. We could either do it with staff, which we don't. We would have to add staff. We don't have staff currently. Or we could contract that work out.
So the revenue generated from alternative one or two, from the fees, both mooring and camping, would go where?
So that's a great segue to the slide I'm going to talk about here.
Great.
Before you go there, just want to note something she mentioned before, that each of the four alternatives have that no change of land ownership. That's something that's evolved in recent weeks. Mm-hmm. The port and the PUD both recognize it needs to be a partnership going forward. The shape of that partnership is yet to be determined.
Before we go on to answer your question, Commissioner, I wanted to also mention that we thought about the do-nothing alternative, which is just to step back and say, no support, we're not going to do nothing, or even removing it from our license. Those two we removed from consideration. We just feel that the district's legacy and our continued commitment to the parks just didn't make those good recommendations. So staff is not recommending those alternatives, and we have not considered them further.
Question. That was my – actually, that was going to be on one of my alternative lists, which would be to remove the park from our district boundary. And I think I was told that that cannot be done, or it's just not recommended because of the fact that we have a legacy of providing and maintaining parks.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent question and worth spending a minute to talk about. We thought really hard about could we remove it from our license and what would that take? It's always possible to try and remove an existing park from your license with the FERC, with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The problems we see associated with that would be normally you have to have a lot of public support and a lot of agency support, a lot of local support, if you will, to remove a park from your project boundary. We would basically have to justify that to FERC that we no longer need that park. And that's really hard for us to do because that park is full. So we do have a lot of visitors that use that park. And we also felt that we, from the public surveys and the information we received, that trying to get public support to remove it from our license would be very difficult to get that kind of support.
You know, we have parks 12 miles away and 19 miles away, north and south, big parks providing all kinds of different amenities. So, and you know, when I go back and look at this list. 14 parks, which you said includes that park. Mm-hmm. Okay, 13 other parks, 800 acres, 12 boat launches, 324 campsites, 12 sports fields. I mean, we have a tremendous, list of parks and amenities that we provide, and our costs are going up and our revenues are going down, and, you know, we just can't keep taking on everything that people want to hand to us because they can't afford to keep them going. I mean, And we do know from surveys, we know that the park is used very little by the local people anymore. It's I know there are church groups that go in there and spend the night, and they'll bring 150 kids in there. So I don't know. I just if it's something we just cannot do, then I am personally one commissioner interested in, you know, the least amount of change alternative one. Partner with the port. However, if we do get more involved, Michelle, and I'm almost done, Randy, if we did get more involved, if the PUD jumps in and takes on more of the maintenance or whatever, we do need to bring docks up to standard, bathroom, right? Up to bathrooms up to standard, and that's going to be a huge cost.
Something we will talk about later with that respect is we know that in discussions with the port and with RCO that we might be able to tap RCO through the port for additional funding for those capital improvements. So that's something we're exploring.
What's RCO?
Is that the grant that then we're locked in for perpetuity? That's
it
not
would
the
be
grant
for the port. It wouldn't be for the PUD. PUD can't use RCO monies because of our FERC licenses. Recreation Conservation Office. It's the old Interagency for Outdoor Recreation Committee.
Yeah, I think perhaps a counter view is that there will never be more public property available on any of our projects. And to step away from what we currently would have an opportunity to provide for a local park, I think would be less than what we've stood for since Exhibit R.
Just a point of clarification. The alternative comparison chart we're looking at now, does that reflect these options here?
So, and I think some of this gets to, Ann, your questions here, too. Let's go through number one a little bit carefully. This seems to be the least change option and has the potential, as Jeff was mentioning, that the if the port keeps their ownership of the property, basically, this is status quo with some additional funding by Chelan PUD. So they would continue to contract and oversee the operation maintenance of the park. We would have some negotiated financial support, not unlike what we do to support our other operators and managers of parks like INEAT, Manson, and state parks. The revenue, camping revenue, those fees do help offset a lot of the operating costs. So keeping camping, we should not forget that, you know, that does help with that. We're, as I'll mention a little bit in the next slide after this one, is that the land ownership question is becoming more and more evident to us that there may not be value or benefit in the PUD taking on the land ownership, and in fact keeping it the way it is with the port owning it makes them eligible to get more grant funding. And since it's already in perpetuity, they are open to going out and trying to get more funding. That funding can be for some of the things, Commissioner Congdon, that you mentioned, which is like the boat boat dock pilings we know need to be replaced in the next 5 years. They can get some funding through the state grant funding to help some of those capital expenditures. So under the estimated capital expenditure column, we just early look know that there's going to be some money that's needed in those parks. We're going to do a condition assessment to bring you back a little bit more information on that. But all of those items have potential to get future grant funding. So that can reduce some of those items if they can get those grants. The biggest change here would be on the annual O&M side. So if the port is willing to continue to contract for the O&M, we envision that we would, as the PUD, maybe help support some of the or offset some of the costs that aren't made up with that. So the port has told us that they are basically the camping itself and the moorage for the concessionaire that they've hired comes out about a net zero with the camping revenues. They're able to offset most of the operating costs. What they haven't been able to fund or haven't been charging the concessionaire is insurance and some of the water system costs, which is about $27,000 a year for the port. And then obviously any capital improvements aren't funded out of that either. So that's where we were thinking maybe some of the grant funding could help support those capital expenditures. But the port is looking for help financially to offset what they're not making up in the revenues. So we're looking at that to be somewhere between $25,000 and $55,000 per year. In any given year, it kind of swings. But maybe there's a negotiated amount there that we can help support the port in that annual O&M.
Shell, we provide some funding now, correct?
No. So the funding that we've provided so far has been rather sporadic. In relicensing, we gave them $25,000. That was all we gave them in relicensing, and that was to replace an irrigation system. Currently, we do not subsidize the port.
Okay. Thank you.
Question, and I realize we got the survey, and it's been some time back, and maybe it was addressed in the survey questions, maybe it was not. The question that keeps percolating in my brain is about who uses the port, the park. Has overnight camping and overnight boat docking created what I would call a self-fulfilling prophecy. If there was a change from overnight use to day use, as in a, let's say, a alternative number four, how would the makeup of the camp users or the park users change over time? Did you get any sense in the surveys you took how that might change?
Yes, we did get a fairly good response in the survey questions on that. And one of the unique features of a small park that's 5 acres, that is not a state park, not one of the bigger camping areas like we have at BB or Lincoln or Droga, is that it's a small park. And we heard during the survey information is that it's a lot of groups use it. So church groups, family reunions, that those kinds of users. Is I don't know if any of you have tried to get a large group into a park. It's hard to do. And what we've learned is that this small park is unique in that way. It offers a place where people can reserve for large groups. The getting at your question specifically, we know that park gets about 75,000 users per year. That is based on car counts. So it could, change from year to year. And specifically, it's based on the number of cars and times the number of people that we get that number. But that is a well-used park. And I do think that compared to our other parks, all parks in our Rocky Reach, Rock Island, and Chelan reservoirs are at 100% capacity on peak weekends, no matter where you are. So, and a lot of that use is coming from the west side. We know that that's a large percentage. But we also learned, surprising to us, that there are a lot of local people that use Arondo because they can get relatives and families in there to use the park where they can't get in other local areas like that. So we were a little surprised by that. But there are, I did get some visitor information for you, Commissioner, that you asked that question in October as well. And from a camping perspective, we see during the peak season about 130 people per day. You have to remember we have, 13 RV sites and 25 campsites. So that's a lot of visitors. And we do know that the current management was really probably over using the park areas, putting a lot more campers in there, especially tent campers, than what the capacity. We know that on a day use, about 216 people per day. Again, this is during the peak summer months on a weekend. So it is a well-used park. But our other parks are full as well. So
yeah, and that doesn't directly get to the question that's in my brain of how, if there were a change, how would I'm assuming the park would be fully utilized. I'm wondering how it would be utilized if there was a change. If it would be a whole lot more local families, not having family from the west side come over, but having their picnic there because and it's not available to them now. Mm-hmm. And we don't know that. I mean, that's a tough one.
That would be hard to estimate if we went to strictly day use and a lot of the outside people that are coming to the park weren't using that park.
Right.
I think I understand your question better.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that on a day use perspective, one thing we learned in the survey is that there are a lot of people locally that would like to use the park as day use. The boat launch especially, and again, that would remain as a day use facility or amenity at that park. The boat launch is used quite heavily. Mm-hmm. And that is, we heard from people from Waterville, from all over, that they, you know, like the location of that boat launch there. So that
they want it expanded.
That's next. Course.
What?
That's next. No, just to follow up on Michelle's comment, what she just stated is what we heard informally prior to the survey. And what was surprising to me personally were people that live in that area that camp and in that park when they can. So there's also a desire for them to have the ability 1 mile away to take their family and go camp for the weekend.
Yeah, the demand for our parks is always a hard question to answer, and that is something that we study very specifically during relicensing. And then at Rocky Reach, you have to do that halfway through your license. You have to do a new demand study to find out if your parks are keeping up with demand. So that demand question comes up a lot and is something that we have to consider with our parks. I don't want to shortchange the other options here. So number two, again, is with the PUD taking over much more of the operation and maintenance, but again, maintaining the overnight camping features. Probably the most costly because we do not have staff. We would have to contract that out. You still have to manage the contractor. The camping could bring in revenue, so we could offset some of those costs. Options three and four, again, taking away the overnight amenities, turning it into day use. However, we're going to see in the public support or the public survey that there was a lot of support for the camping, but it was about 50-50. So, I think that is worthy of some consideration as we move forward. I think the boat launching is probably the most acknowledged feature in that park.
Michelle, I have a question. Is it just for clarity in my own mind, is option one the only option where the sign doesn't change to reflect it as a PUD park? That's right?
That's right.
So option one, it's still reflected as a port property, port park.
That's correct.
And therefore the amenities are not potentially at the same level of amenities that the Chelan PUD has for all of their facilities. So the amenities could be at a, let's say, a lower threshold, therefore maybe a lower cost.
That's correct.
All right, thank you.
So, Michelle, I wonder if alternative three, which is taking on more the flavor of a natural area, I wonder if that's something that the Chelan Douglas Land Trust would partner with us somehow. Because that would be really, I think that would be a real wonderful addition to have some more natural area and some nice natural trails and so something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really changing the environment of the park. It would be a different experience, obviously, if we did that.
We don't have very many of those.
We don't. And Coyote Dunes, which we will be working on in the next several years, is probably the closest that we have. The wildlife area, Haran Wildlife Areas, mm-hmm. is another one.
I think that'd be nice.
But yeah, those are popular. I'll move on, Pat. Mm-hmm. Any more questions on this slide before I move on? This is just really recapping some of the considerations that we've discussed. Keeping the park open supports our legacy and continued commitment of providing parks for the enjoyment of the public. You have also brought up very good points about the proximity to other parks that we have. So we should be thinking about that in terms of the cost of taking on more here at Arondo Park. We do not currently have staff that could take on operation and maintenance. So we would have to, if we were to take on more of a commitment and did not contract, we would have to look at the option of contracting versus trying to increase staff to take on Arondo Park. We do know that there's some safety parks. That park is in need of some love and care. It has been abused, overpopulated in terms of the camping for many years, and it needs some help, which is why we are recommending a full condition assessment and an environmental assessment there. I mentioned that we've been thinking more about the ownership considerations, and we want to point out that owning the property is not required by our license. So the fact that the park is part of our license, one of our Exhibit R parks, we don't have to own the property to have it in our license, but we have to have an agreement with the port that they are willing to keep it as a park for the life of our license. So we would have to continue some type of an agreement with the Port of Douglas County if they were to keep the ownership and maintenance of it. We would have to have a continued long-term agreement with them. But owning the property is not we don't need to own that property to have it as part of our license.
What are the pluses and minuses of owning or not owning?
So the pluses of us owning would just be that we would own a piece of property that we currently don't, and we would have more say over what happens on that property, obviously, with that. We couldn't quite frankly think of many other pluses for owning the property. It came down to more negatives, and I think that you'll see more negatives here in that we were really hoping that the port would be able to go out and maybe help support some of these capital investments through further grant funding. That's what that's there for, so it would be nice maybe to see that happen. We also know that there was a gas leak there. In the early 2000s. It's been cleaned up. Ecology has signed off on it, but we don't know what's underlying that. So we intend to do some due diligence around the environmental effort to review the paperwork on that more so than we have now. We just had some preliminary looks at that. But we just think that there's probably greater risk taking on the ownership of that property when we don't have to, especially since it's encumbered.
And if there has been discussion, what is the is there a range in terms of what people would think that would be of value?
I'm looking at our real estate services person, Vicki. Would you like to respond to that, or do you want me to give the high level? I'm going to let Vicki Griffin, our real estate services manager, answer that question.
Good morning. As far as Vicki Griffin, real estate manager, as far as advantages and the value, I would be hard-pressed to put a number on it simply because it's encumbered in perpetuity to be used for recreational purposes. So it would be a piece of waterfront that the district could say that they own. But there isn't any, we could never resell it. We could never use it for anything other than for park purposes. So, in my opinion, there isn't any real monetary value to owning the property.
Good. Thank you.
And so I would support that. I think Vicki's absolutely right. And it's also in the project boundary. And we know that.
Well, I just didn't want it to be seen as a revenue stream.
Just do a brief high level on the survey results. Over 300 respondents, and I think the key message points here are very clear. Day use is important. However, making it day use only, received 13% in terms of respondents saying that would be very important to them to see it as day use only, 23% somewhat. Overnight camping, again, about 50-50 on that one, very important. But another 25% is somewhat important. So 75% overall, camping was valuable. Boat launch received the highest marks. I think that boat launch is is very well used. I'm an important to the community and to people using the river. Boat moorage also received fairly high marks. 49% thought it was very important. 31% somewhat important. So kind of up there with the overnight, with the camping, the overnight moorage as well was fairly important to some people.
And refresh my memory on, you had 300 respondents. That's a huge number. Where'd they come from?
So most of the respondents were local. We advertised it locally, customer owners. We also sent out flyers. We had the public meeting up at Orondo. So very local respondents. These were customer owners, some Douglas County respondents, but all local. And again, with these, we can get a gauge and kind of a sense for what people are thinking. It's sometimes kind of hard to read, but we did not send out the survey to the West Side. It was website based, and most of it was done and received. The respondents were local.
So you can identify when they respond from a email where they're from?
Most of the people gave us their email address or their address, because we also had a drawing. So we asked for some more information for that. And so we did get a pretty good idea where most of the people were.
Were most of them Chelan County or Douglas County?
We had about 50-50, Suzanne? Okay, Suzanne is telling me about 50-50.
Okay. I'd be really curious on the 50% being Douglas County, how that would look. If you can do that.
We will take an attempt at that.
Michelle, I just one quick question on boat launch. Is there a fee collected to launch a boat there?
Yes.
There is. So yes. Launching and moorage,
yes,
are two separate fees.
That's right. The boat launch, I have these numbers. The boat launch is $7 launch.
Wow.
Overnight moorage is $10.
That's excuse the interrupt. That's really, really low. I mean, compared to Lake Chelan, I think Lake Chelan is $20 to launch a boat.
Is that right?
And overnight is over $100. So those are really low, but there is a real need for boat launch and boat moorage.
Yeah,
I know on the river.
And the launching is, you know, from a recreation perspective, from a license perspective, the reason we have parks is for access to the river.
Yeah.
And so that boat launching is very fundamental to our reason for having parks in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
Commissioner.
Michelle, this is really interesting data to me. Because I think the survey data, and I think getting to the question that was raised over here, would be most helpful, as well as to trying to narrow it down to the community. Because, you know, the boat launch and the boat moorage, I understand that from community people, that would be really important to them. But what surprises me is that these numbers aren't opposite. I would have expected these to be completely different, that community members would not want overnight, would not want the noise, would not want all that, and would like to see it returned to a day use.
Mm-hmm.
And can you, is there anything else that you can expand on that or enlighten us on that data?
You know, we were surprised with that as well. And the public meeting really was where it turned around in my mind, that I was thinking the same thing that you're mentioning, which is I would think the local people would want to see that day use and return it, because that's how it was originally constructed, was for a day use park. But at the community meeting, and we had a couple of commissioners there, so I was surprised at the number of local people that came to that meeting that said, we use that park, and we use it for camping, or we use it for boat launching. And it almost seemed like the local people used it almost as much for camping, because they bring their families there. So I was surprised as well, with just in a public meeting, to hear that. But then also when we got the respondents and the survey information, it kind of started all fitting together to me that there's a lot more local people that use that park than I had thought, or that I would have imagined. And it's hard to kind of sort out when you do a survey like this exactly, if they're reading the question the same way and how they use the park. And so we have to just kind of use these as a gauge a little bit. But I think what we learned was that more local people use that park for the camping or for the boat launching than we originally thought.
I surmise that, you know, based on the comments at the community meeting as well as informally and on the telephone, that they feel like they've lost control of their park because there has been so much outside influence. But by the same token, they want to retain all the facilities that are there for the benefit of the local community, which is the reason the park was put in the first place.
Yeah, I was surprised at the community meeting that there weren't very, I didn't think there were very many community members there. There were a lot of port officials there. And a lot of us PUD folks, but I think I only spoke to three or four community folks there. But yes, I did hear that too, that when you have a large group of 125 kids in there, you can't, the local folks can't get it. Are there any, well, you did say that they are over, what's the word, saturate, that they bring in more, allow more people to use it and camp overnight than they can support.
The recent concessionaire was really packing in the, especially the tent sites, really utilizing as much of that lawn area as they could, and more than the 25 sites that are actually numbered in there. But which is really why that park, you know, we need to take a year and spend some time taking care of that park. They can't water the lawn when you have tent sites covering it. So even the maintenance and care of the lawn area has been really falling behind because they haven't been able to, they've been trying to hand water areas when there's not a camper. Mm. I mean, it's been, you know, but they're trying to make as much money as they can to keep things going. So. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been an issue at that park. Okay. Some of the themes we heard, again, group camp, a big push for gas and the fueling station. All of that has been removed. We don't anticipate bringing that back.
Good.
But everything has been removed except for the dispenser, which we anticipate will be part of our safety improvement list of things to take out. But the tanks and everything have been removed already from the park. A lot of people have been going there for many years. We did get a lot of comments back that it's rather noisy and more of a party atmosphere, and I think that's just the management.
Do they allow alcohol?
There's not supposed to be alcohol, mm-hmm. but... I don't know too many people that camp that don't have mm-hmm. alcohol, but parking is, or alcohol is not allowed in the park.
So there's no enforcement.
There's no enforcement.
Or not much enforcement. Yeah.
Oh, what did I do here? Here we go. Overcrowded, need some updates and more professional approach to operation maintenance. So. With the assessments that we need to do, staff is recommending a plan for next year, for 2018. We're calling it an interim operations plan. The port has agreed to continue to manage the park for limited day use operations, so we're intending to keep the boat launch open, but we would close and cancel the camping for next year. And this would allow for the condition assessment, some safety improvements, and really just some reconditioning of the park. It also allows us to bring back some information to you as the board so we can bring you everything we've learned about the park and make a decision about April or May of next year on the future for the park. We have budgeted $300,000 that was in the approved budget to do some initial safety improvements. And we also plan to complete the condition and environmental assessments, as I mentioned earlier.
Just a note on that $300,000, it doesn't mean that we would spend it. It's just there as a placeholder in the event the assessment determines there are priorities, and we know there are, that need to be addressed from a safety standpoint.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. And then the advantages of that are just giving us the time to develop our agreements. We can address the safety concerns, keep the boat launch open, meets our obligation to keep the park open. There's also an RCO obligation to keep the park open, so we would have to get approvals from both of those agencies to close the park completely. This keeps our obligation of keeping those open. And then preserves our opportunity for a later decision from the board once we know more. So kind of taking us back then to our anticipated schedule, January 8th.
Before we go
yes,
on,
Commissioner.
Just so that I'm clear, the allowing partial closure, so we were talking about, I want to make sure I understand the difference between day use, would that mm-hmm. still occur and people could still use the grassy areas, or would those, would it be just boat launch and dock, and but the camping is out and
for this so, year
for
this for, year. For 18
for 18 yes
but it, so clarify from my point
yes
the day use operation
yes and that's a great question. So the question that we've been considering is, do we just keep, you know, let's say half of the park open with the launching and close the rest of the park, you know, the other half of the park off? Let me get up here to show you. So most of the day use features obviously are here with the boat launch area. We have a gazebo here that's actually on our property and something that the PUD constructed. Currently, our park staff are afraid that that is in dire strait of needing repair before it collapses. So we may want to consider, if we open up the entire park next year for day use, that maybe we do something about that gazebo, or maybe we just keep day use only this portion and close off this part of the park and really try and recondition this other half, take care of the safety. We have some erosion work. The lawn is in need of care. We can work on some of this, but maybe just keep the parking, the boat launch, the restroom, you know, the picnic some of the picnic tables in this area, and really just trying to close off maybe half of it. That's one option we're considering for the day use component. The other option is just keep the whole thing open for day use, allow the picnicking and the use that's going on. But until we really do a little more of the condition assessment, we don't want to let people in there to use it as day use if there's safety components that we need to fix that we might need to close portions of that off. So the condition assessment will give us a little better answer to your question. But at a minimum, we would be keeping this portion, which is the boat launch and the restroom and the parking.
And realizing, too, that anything we do would be in an agreement and partnership with Douglas Port. That hasn't been negotiated yet.
Thank you.
So at what point in time does the $300,000 that's budgeted kick in and dollars start to get spent?
So we plan to do the condition assessment first, and then we can prioritize those safety improvements that we need to do right away. So we would assume that when the board makes the decision in May, we would be laying out a prioritized list of the things that we need to see done. And we would also be working with the port on things that are maybe 5 years out, that can wait 5 years, for example, where we might be able to go, or the Port of Douglas County might be able to get some grant funding. So we're going to be looking at all of the options in terms of what needs to be done right away, the things that we think the PUD could or should fund, what things are a little bit further out, maybe the 2 to 5 year range and then a 5 to 10 year range, and then decide some different funding alternatives there and working with the port on that. So Commissioner Arsenal, I imagine that about May is when we would come back with the information that can answer that better, which would be, here's our prioritized list, and we have $300,000, and we think that these are the option, the things that should be funded with that money.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Good presentation.
Thank you. If I can, I have just one more. There's a something that I'd like to see as you're moving forward in terms of consideration, and it would be maybe a slight modification on alternative one. If the PUD were to cover O&M costs and allow the port to continue to own property and be concerned with the capital cost so that they could go out and get grant money, and the PUD would simply be covering, their liability would just be O&M going forward. I'd like to see what that would look like. And whether or not, because then based on this example, the port would have the authority to collect revenues from all the fee-generating amenities and apply that towards capital improvements along with grant money. So I'd like to kind of see how that would look.
Make sure we understand. So in this scenario, this option, port would only be responsible for the capital improvements, pursuing that through RCO. PUD would operate, and they would still own the property. PUD would operate and manage the park. Is that right?
No, no. So the okay. So the only role the PUD would play would be to cover operational and maintenance costs. Okay. So the park would still, the signage would still identify it as a Port of Douglas park, and that the Port of Douglas would be responsible for all capital costs going forward. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then using the revenues collected from both moorage, boat launch, and camping, or however they would like to run the park, mm-hmm. to cover the capital expense, as well as have the ability then to go out and get grants.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think what I would be really helpful is, yeah, when we come back in January, we can maybe go through all of those costs in more detail.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be helpful to you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Congdon.
So, Michelle or Jeff, I don't know, probably both of you, that's tricky. That's difficult. I know with the Manson Park, it's the same arrangement. Manson is, the PUD takes care of generally O&M and Manson, the larger capital items, but correct? But they often can't afford, and if they don't, and for example, here in this situation, if they don't get the grant funding, they won't be able to afford the capital, large capital expenditures, and so then that falls on the PUD, and that's just kind of an ongoing cycle of, you know, yeah, we're supposed to take care of it, but we don't have the money for, I mean, you know, docks and mortgage repair. That's very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's tricky business.
It is tricky, and typically the revenues that are made from camping or boat launching, it might cover some of your normal operation and maintenance costs, but very seldom can you collect enough to pay for mm-hmm. those large capital expenditures, mm-hmm. which is why many of our operating partners have gone out and tried to find grants or other sources, or have come back to the PUD and right. said, we can't afford this, can you?
Right.
So a lot of our agreements, in fact, say that we will fund the larger capital items, and we do.
That's the way it goes. That's how it ends up.
We do that with any app, even.
Yeah.
So it's parks are a hard business to be lucrative in them, and they usually aren't. So oftentimes it's the cost of having our license, and the PUD has really been great about standing up and funding that. But it's, as you saw, $5 million just for the parks we operate and maintain. It's a lot of money to continue, but it's a fantastic asset as well.
Commissioner Congdon.
One more quick question: the water for irrigation of that big lawn, that large lawn. Do they have their own pump? They're pumping out of the river. What could you find out what the costs are for that and what that looks like?
Sure.
So irrigation versus no irrigation, going back to natural, which means more weeding, but no irrigation.
Okay. I'll get that
Thanks.
Mindy?
Yes.
You know, when I look at the cost of our parks and 3.5 million people visiting them, you know, there's not a lot legally that the PUD can become involved in economic development. But one of the things that I think is a hallmark contribution to this organization, you know, is the establishment of the parks, the number of people who come, the number of people who spend money on a daily basis being here, And I think it's an economic stimulus to the county. And I think we need to kind of, you know, weigh and consider that as well. You know, the public asked us in our survey, you know, if we could become more involved in economic development, and we're limited. This is one area where we can continue to push into that area and make a strong economic. Just remember about a year ago sitting at a local restaurant, and two couples had come over from the Seattle area to just generally recreate, and found that the salmon were running, and dropped, no pun intended, a boatload of money to rent a boat to go to Hooked on Toys to supply up. It was completely spontaneous, and just eavesdropping on their conversation. It's really nice that the salmon were running, and you know. And, but I'm just saying, I think we need to be careful about losing track of the economic contribution to the greater area, you know, based on maintaining those parks. And no one ever has approached me from out of the area that utilizes the parks with a negative comment. It's a draw. We have neighbors who specifically live here, moved here from Tacoma to take advantage of the parks in their retirement. You know, so it's a great thing we have going.
Yes.
There has to be at some point some caution, and I think one of the important things for me in looking at this is to as we negotiate through this, if we you know, pick up the partnership, is to negotiate specifically with Douglas County Port to ensure diligence in seeking the grants for recreational grants, because that would certainly ease the financial burden. And I know there are capital projects that wouldn't fall under that, but a great deal of the amenities would, and that's a partnership that I think we would really want to encourage and favor. So.
Commissioner Congdon.
Quick kudos to Antioch Parks, the community of Antioch and Manson, for keeping those parks. That's a real source of pride for them, and it's not easy. You know, it's a struggle for them, and they take on as much of much of the capital expenditures as they possibly can. As you say, most everybody else has handed the parks back to the PUD, but Antioch and Manson have kept them, and it's been very difficult, but it's very important to them.
Absolutely.
So congratulations, and I wanted to say that publicly. That's a wonderful thing they're doing.
Yep.
We appreciate them.
Agree.
Any other questions or comments? Just one curveball. I like doing that sometimes. Based on today's conversation, the exploration of the option of transferring our 2 acres to the port, along with a combination of us operating, continuing in the license, might open up grant monies to all 5 acres rather than just three.
Commissioner, we've learned from, Eric Walquist, we've learned from FERC that they won't allow us to transfer fee of ownership interests we have within the
That makes life simple.
Yeah. Well, see, that's practical, Randy, and that doesn't always happen.
Federal agency. But I was just thinking about lessening the cost on it.
Yeah.
Short answer, no.
Yeah. Okay.
So Eric had his mitt on.
Yeah.
And if I may, Steve Wright did ask me to pass on that he does that as staff we do understand that there are a lot of variations here and a lot of things to think about. So the chance for the subsequent discussions is part of that, to be able to come back in January with some more thoughts, more discussion, and just do that interim, what do we need to do kind of in this short term, because the park doesn't wait and the park season doesn't wait.
Right.
But while we gather that additional information and learn, there will be more chance for discussion and learning and what the ultimate variation of the options can be for the longer term.
I think those recommendations for what to do in the interim are really good.
Yeah, we've got some choices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as usual, we spend an hour talking about a $100,000 item.
Very emotional item.
It is. Yeah. The parks are very emotional.
It's no easy answer.
No.
Thank you, Commissioner Bitt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. No.
Thank you.
Good job. A lot of work put into this. Thank you.
Item five, increase in applications for service.
Welcome, Matt. John Stoll. And Chad Bowman.
Morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities, and with me I have...
Good morning, Chad Bowman, Director of Transmission and Compliance.
So we're here today. It was 2 weeks ago. I did a quick update under a manager item, just kind of what we're seeing from a staff perspective, from a lot of combination of people looking to site their cryptocurrency, or what we're going to call Bitcoin mining operations. I believe I quoted the price 2 weeks ago was $11,300 a Bitcoin, and that was a meteoric rise. Well, today it's at $19,000 2 weeks later. So,
wow.
It's a really dynamic, it's a really fast time. So my intention here is just to kind of go through what are some of the current issues. Kim has passed out a one-pager. We envision putting this out there on our website so the community can see just some of the issues we're working through. So I'm not going to read.
18,790.
What? How much?
18,790.01.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. So I'm not going to read this, but I'll just maybe pull out some highlights with a little bit of commentary around it. Chad's here because we're seeing some very large load requests that, you know, really start to involve the transmission and larger studies outside of customer utilities. So pretty much gave you the background and what we're seeing from a price perspective. This document talks a little bit about the history from when we put in the moratorium back in 2015, and we went through the HDL rate-making process and policy, but where we're at now, it's really, again, with all these applicants and people who are just doing inquiries and conversations, it's really putting a lot of stress on staff, who, as we've worked through the budget process, you know, we have a lot of priorities around substations, hooking up new homes, businesses, kind of what we would call our organic growth, which is busier than it has been. So, but this is just to kind of walk through some of the things. I think I mentioned last time that, you know, it seems like every time I go into an office, whether it's Kathy Melton over here or Lyle Moore or Andy, people are dealing with requests about information. I know we pride ourselves on the customer experience and working through a lot of customer questions, but it's to the point where we have a lot of just being inundated with questions. It's not uncommon to get 10 different inquiries coming in 10 different channels because there's a lot of enthusiasm. And when folks look at our rates and whatnot, they want to explore that and explore it in detail. So some of the things we're seeing, again, when we look at these very large requests is, you know, the safety and reliability issues. We've talked about it from even at the residential level. We, in fact, Carrie Wendell spends quite a bit of time when we identify high load usage in homes. There's an investigation process to find out what it is. Generally, they turn out to be, not all cases, but generally somebody's doing a mining operation. And as we've discussed, when you've got that system and that transformer going full out, which they're not designed to do, that creates issues. So it's really incumbent upon us to work with those folks that we uncover and work through a process so they get an application in with the right fees so we can study it to see what needs to be done. Weekly they uncover those, and it consumes a lot of staff time. And then you get into the process of putting on special metering and monitoring. And then what do you do when they fail to turn off their equipment? So then it creates a lot of in follow-up and issues to deal with. I know nobody likes to shut off customers, but we're to the point where we're having to look at that very earnestly when we run into these situations. As I mentioned earlier, we're seeing more on the large-scale side, 30, 40, up to 200-megawatt load requests. And some of these folks are very serious, so how do we process that? What does Chad Bowman and his team need to do to understand an impact like that? At the substation level, more on the smaller ones and the commercial, you know, when we get a application and it takes time to go through, and what do we need to do? Maybe we need to upsize transformers. Maybe we need to put different protection in our system. Or in some instances, we just don't have the capacity. And so what does it take to work through that? The one question I think that comes to mind, too, when we've talked to some of these very large applicants, they're very eager to get going, and we recognize that a lot of these potential applications would take a lot of what I would call infrastructure in potentially a customer-owned substation, potentially a transmission improvement. Not sure, but as we know, our customers highly value being involved when it comes to infrastructure projects and what happens. So part of this is just in this communication is letting folks know that when we get to that order and magnitude of requests. There's another dynamic that I think folks are coming in from out of the area, and they understand the Alcoa curtailment. So there's an initial reaction that maybe there's some power from the Alcoa situation that they could potentially utilize, and you know, and that's they're currently under contract for that, so that's something that, you know, it's not for the PUD to get involved with, but that's one of the drivers for some of these very large folks that come in. But I think they still keep looking around for what are areas, other areas they may be able to cite. Interesting, I think we're seeing some of these large applicants are going around and they're doing purchase and sale agreements on properties pending power availability. And again, that's just another dynamic that I don't think we've seen before, and it takes a while to understand that, especially when you're talking anything, you know, even in the large industrial size of, you know, 1 to 5 megawatts, it takes a while to work through that. Where we're talking, again, 30, 40, 50 megawatts, some of these folks are thinking about. So what we're doing is we're putting in a process. We've got a form on our website that we're really directing a lot of these inquiries to go to. It's not very detailed. It's maybe 10 questions, but it really gets down to what are you looking at? You know, who are you? Do you have an area in mind? And there's lots of information, FAQs, things of that nature. And we ask those potential applicants to work through it. We do have a lot in the queue already, so our priority is to work with the ones who put in an application and paid the fees. But the folks who are still in kind of the inquiry mode to really work through that process to try and understand what does that look like. We're not opposed to maybe even when we have enough of these together, there's opportunities maybe to do like a pre-application or an open house type setting to answer more of these questions that maybe these folks have. So that's what we're doing. You know, again, we're focusing on our current priorities and folks that we have application fees in and they're complete. And as we move forward with more of these requests, we're trying to put just a process in place. And a new dynamic, as I mentioned earlier, and Chad will speak to this more, when we get into these very large requests, that's just something we don't deal with that on a normal basis. Like I said, ask Chad if he wanted to.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me up here. So, again, I'm responsible for the transmission system, so really keeping that system reliable and operating day-to-day is very important to me. NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, actually has a few reliability standards that address, amongst other things, the addition of large loads or generators or transmission, new transmission interconnections. And part of those standards require that a transmission study be done when those things occur. So right now, our threshold for those studies is set at 5 megawatts. We haven't, as John says, done any of those in the past because we haven't had those types of requests. We certainly haven't had requests in the 50 to 100 megawatt category before. So the question is, how do you process those?
How do you do those studies? How do you keep the system reliable? What infrastructure improvements may or may not be necessary? So we're kind of thinking, as we're working through these things, is there a way to tier those studies into different levels of complexity? So there's an easier study to begin with that provides at least some level of is this feasible, is this not feasible, and then the developer could choose to move on to the next study and so on and so forth. But it's certainly a very interesting thing to think through, something we haven't done before, something that really from a resource perspective we don't have the resources to address probably in a very timely way.
Especially with the speed of the value of Bitcoin change.
Yes.
Right. Hopefully they understand our ability to respond. We have to be methodical.
So any more feedback? We appreciate it, but basically our message is we want to work with these potential applicants and the folks that have applied, but we just have to do this process and recognize it's going to take time to work through some of these issues. I would also imagine as we will probably be at some point back to the board with maybe policy updates. Just when we see this type of activity, we don't know what it will ultimately end up being, but it certainly would anticipate some policy changes.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Gary. No, please. No. Thank you.
John, just a question. Do these applicants know whether or not they have contacted or spoken with the port at all, Chelan Port?
Some of them have, yeah.
Some
of them go around, and I think the port may even take them to various properties, but it's strictly on a property standpoint. They'll contact, I think, local real estate agents, and they'll work through that. Some of them just cold call us. I drove up here from California, or I flew in, and I'd like to speak to the manager of Rocky Reach.
There we go.
So I think so, in some areas, I think from overseas, there's more of a link to the generating facilities.
My question is related to conversations that I know have been ongoing related specifically to, you know, with the communities as far as zoning. And so kind of where is that direction going? I know there's concern about having businesses in residential neighborhoods. Et cetera. So I'm just curious, just kind of an update on that aspect of it.
I believe it's fairly emerging. I know we've had conversations with the municipalities and, you know, trying to just let them know what's going on where we can. And I think it's becoming more, I think, in their world as well. And I think they're thinking through some of those issues right now.
Okay. Yeah, because that'd be really helpful. If we're going to serve large loads, that if they're in a given area rather than dispersed, I think that's a very different proposition for us, mm-hmm. and that would be helpful. And I think it'd be helpful in terms of, you know, safety in neighborhoods. And
yes, yeah, I would agree.
Is our pricing structure that we spent about a year and a half developing influencing this to what level?
That's, I think to some degree, and I would say in the smaller ones where it's more the commercial size, I think, you know, that upfront 190 per kilowatt is, that's significant when you talk, you know, 100, 200, 300, but I don't think it's insurmountable when you look at the price of what Bitcoins are going for. Our rate itself, I think when you average it all out between the demand base and the energy charge, it's around 4.5 cents at that commercial level. So I think the really large ones, if they continue through with applications and want to move forward, that gets into a contract discussion. Mm. And then it's a whole, again, back – not unlike some of the transmission issues, developing large retail contracts is something, you know, we don't do that very often. In fact, we've been working on one that's taken us probably 6-7 months, and it's still in a pretty draft form.
Okay, thank you.
John, you alluded to turning some customers off. Can you explain that a little bit more to me? Maybe I didn't hear what you were saying, but are you seeing people trying to sneak things past us and push the envelope? And
yes, we see that. There's a number of folks who, for whatever reason, maybe they just don't know. They start, getting some of these mining machines or whatever equipment they use, and they start mining. And usually what happens when we do our monthly meter read, we will go out and it triggers a high usage. We have an algorithm that looks back and says, whoa, you've used a tremendous amount more energy than you normally. So that we do that as a customer service offering. There may be something going on within the home. We'll just share that with the customer. But usually I think now that we're seeing these more and more, there's some telltale signs that there's some mining activity going on. And then that triggers follow-up calls, letters, asking them to stop doing that. Some folks will, this is what I'm doing in my basement or shop and what have you, and we'll ask them to stop for those safety and reliability reasons, as well as complying with our policy. Mm-hmm. Some do, some it's a bit of a cat and mouse game. And so then we put out in what we call a load profile meter. So that's a truck roll where our meter shop goes out there, installs this meter, and then at a certain interval, you have to go back and you have to probe that meter and download the information. And that will give you, you'll see the load profile of what's going on. And that's usually really clear. And so then that, again, provides more information. And again, typically, if they're still mining, it's please cease and desist on that until you put in your application, pay your fees, and then we need to upsize their transformer or their wires. We can move forward on that. The diversity of load is a big challenge. You think about in my house, for example, I have a pad-mounted transformer, and it probably gets stressed in the morning when the hot water tank's going and my heater's going, and then it gets pretty quiet for the rest of the day, where most of these type of operations, they're using as much as they can. So even some of our field staff will go out, and the transformer's too hot to even touch. So the heat buildup and what heat causes in the electric system is not good. So that's really why it's important that this activity is identified and addressed.
Not to necessarily cross-pollinate discussion this morning, but rather than going out and setting up a separate and specific meter, would the smart meters that we're looking at prevent that truck roll?
Exactly, yes. We would have that information pretty much at our fingertips.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for the update. Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And before we move to item 6 very quickly, I realized that back on the Arundo Park, River Park, I didn't ask for any public input and recognize that we've got a representative from the Douglas Port here, Ron Kreidelbaugh. Any comment that based on an hour conversation that...
Exactly.
Okay, very good. But just want to recognize you and give you an opportunity if that was the case. So, okay, you're more than welcome. All right. Item 6, identity theft.
So, Commissioner, I think this is, this is Eric Walquist, General Counsel. I think the next two items are mine. I'll try to wrap them up here as quickly as possible. The first is you may require years ago now that we, in compliance with federal statute, developed and adopted identity theft prevention program here at the PUD. That program, along with the federal statute, requires that we provide at least once a year annual reporting to the governing body of the PUD. So that is what I'm doing today on item number 6. Happy to let you know that the Identity Theft Prevention and Customer Privacy Policy Committee had its meeting on December 8th of 2017, and we have had no red flags to report for 2017. There were some areas of watch that were discussed and agreed to, and we continue to work to improve all of our processes internally with customer service, IT, and at the district in order to meet our compliance obligation with the Identity Theft Prevention Program and to prevent red flags. This is really the what I call the two-step process. First, the confirmation of the person in front of us is indeed who they are representing themselves to be in terms of seeking new service applications. You'll recall that that was one of the reasons that utilities were looped into the Red Flags program was that there was acknowledgement that folks were using utility statements as one method of proving identity at state and other local agencies. So we do need to confirm the person who is in front of us is indeed who they are representing themselves to be. And then we have obligations there under associated with the protection of that personal identifying information and making sure that it's not released in an unauthorized fashion. So nothing of consequent this year, although we continue to work, and you're aware of some of those efforts behind the scenes that we're doing to improve our response and our opportunities to protect that information. So questions about that? It's a good news story. We have had good news stories in a run here, so hopefully we'll continue that. So if there aren't any questions, Commissioner, sorry.
Yes.
Oh, if there aren't,
congratulate you on that. But
oh, well, world. I would appreciate that and accept congratulations, but not on my behalf. It would be on behalf of really our customer service IT teams, compliance manager Melinda Barnes, Carrie Wendell, Greg Larson, Rich Hyatt, Katie Hunt. Those are ones that sit on the committee and attended. So it's really staff's good work. It's not mine. I'm just simply here as the mouthpiece today. So with no further questions on item 6, I'll move to item 7, which is introduction of one of the resolutions, item 16, you'll see later this afternoon, and that really relates to the revision and restatement of the delegated authorities for procurement and contracting services here at the district. You require, or you'll recall back in June or July, we had an initial meeting to talk about revising those policies, and we've had some individual conversations, I know, with you all, and then at the workshop. Back in, was it September now or August, September? There was a conversation, and we've resolved all of the then outstanding issues. And it's been some delay in getting back to you on this matter today simply because we've had such busy agenda items and calendars that we've made a staff decision to push it off. But my metric with Steve is the end of the year, and the effective date of the proposed resolution is the end of the year, which is a nice convenient cutoff. So here we are today. So you'll recall that the fundamental shift in the delegation resolution is from one where the board delegated authorities for signature and contracting down through the organization all the way to the project manager, but delegated in some instances past senior management and the general manager, which seemed inappropriate to me with respect to an ability to sort of control those things and to ensure that there was an appropriate reporting up. There's nothing improper about the board's doing that. It just created the opportunity for a lack of communication upward in the supervisory channel. So working with Steve and other senior staff, we developed the proposal, which we've talked about, and at least so far the board has indicated works for them, which is to delegate all of those authorities to Steve directly as the general manager. And then Steve would, by administrative memorandum, redelegate those authorities downward, probably just to his direct reports with some restrictions on or permissions for their redelegation downward in their own teams. And that is actually convenient because each manager manages their own team differently depending upon its size, structure, et cetera. So that provides an ability to better monitor those redelegations, I think, downward. So Steve and I have had several conversations about his intention in those administrative redelegation. And I have to simply draft it, which is candidly one of the reasons for the January 1, 2018 trigger date. Consistent with the board's instruction in our conversations earlier, there would be, for clarity's sake, a single point of reference for those memorandums. We've proposed to keep that actually with my group, and Karen Welton would be responsible for managing that. So if there was the memo from Steve down to the senior team would redelegate memos presumably down, and those would all go to Karen. She would maintain the master list. There could be links internally on websites, but effectively that will be the one-stop shop for whether you do or don't have signature authority for contracting purposes. Some of the details in the discussion related to the last couple of issues that were resolved in the workshop, I'll remind you. We've retained the $3 million current delegated limit associated with non-exception contracts. All exception contracts still require board approval, just as they do now. So there's no fundamental change to any of those limits. There is a change in the delegated limits associated with service agreements When we talked about it at the workshop, I think the consensus, we didn't make a decision at the time, that's for today, was that there was a comfort level around $500,000, which is an increase over the $200,000 today. But we were not comfortable with fully up to the $3 million contract limit with the other non-exception bids and contracts. So you will see the resolution does reflect that increase in service agreement to $500,000. I would note for service agreements that it also carries and clarifies one issue related to service agreements that, interestingly, you'll see on your agenda for today due to a lack of clarity in the prior delegation resolution, which is where we have, I think it's the Tyson Krupp elevator service agreement, where we have those services that we have agreements that can be extended at the district's election for 1 year periods of time. We have excluded contracts like that from the $500,000 approval limit. So practically speaking, what happens is the first year you don't see it, the second year you don't see it, the third year you don't see it, and then the fourth year it ticks over $200,000 for the first time, and so you do see it. The fact of the matter is we could just as easily, under the current delegation resolution, not simply use the existing service agreement. We could just terminate that and do another one for $50,000, and you would never see it if we did it annually. But for convenience purposes, and also because we're often successful in negotiating good commercial terms as part of those original service agreements, we like to retain the option to extend those. So we've made it clear that where we're only committing for a one-year expenditure, and that one-year expenditure does not exceed the threshold that would require board approval, it would not need board approval. And it's as simple as we could cancel it and do a new one. So it's a bit of a ambiguity in the existing one. So we tend to treat conservatively the board's delegations, and that's why you see it. You look like you have a question, Commissioner. So no? Okay. Just have an inquisitive face today. So the last piece of clarity that we've added, and you'll see in the resolution, is that there's been much confusion related to the delegated authorities and the impacts of field work order change orders. So you'll recall several of the conversations over maybe the last 6 months or board meetings, we've had instances where we've been to you for approval of a change order where it would actually result in a net decrease in the contract value. You would take away a $700,000 piece of equipment, but you would go back and issue a $600,000 piece of equipment. The net result of the contract is a decrease in price of $100,000, but because there's that $600,000 threshold, we would have to come to the board. So we've removed almost all of the opportunities for lack of clarity. We've worked hard, and I want to appreciate and recognize Stacy Jagla and Matt Bowles and my group, because they've been not only completed the PCS audit, but really worked hard on helping me identify opportunities for lack of clarity in the resolution. And what we've landed on is a field work order change order solution that requires board approval when a field work order or collection of field work orders would result in a net contract price increase in excess of $500,000. That's the same $500,000 threshold that appears in the current delegation resolution, but it clarifies the net impact of that as opposed to some of the other opportunities for that clarity. So the only other item that we discussed at the workshop that I've not included in the delegation resolution, even though you were happy with the approach, because I don't think it needs to be in the delegation resolution, is a practice at the district here as part of the board's board agendas. You'll recall back in June or July there was some conversation at the workshop about whether or not it would be appropriate to delegate authority, as we have in small works contracts, to finally accept contracts under a particular threshold. And we talked a little bit about that, and the feedback received in both those instances was that the board was more comfortable with having it on the agenda so that the public would know that there was a contract to completion that would be up for board consideration in case they had an opportunity or desire to come in and comment. So the resolution that we landed on at the workshop was that those final acceptance resolutions, pending an obvious or staff-determined reason to keep them off, would go automatically to the consent agenda, and they would appear there by name and title, and then if the board desired, you would, as part of your normal process, remove those from the board agenda. Yeah. So I think that's an administrative management function that doesn't need to be in a delegation resolution, but wanted to remind you of that in case you begin to see that after the first of the year as your meetings get started. questions about any of those things. It should have met with your expectations. I think it's consistent with all of them. I really sincerely appreciate not only the staff time and comment, there are broad staff comments from PCS and others. And also, in fact, Kelly's the one that had me fix the last piece of the service agreements, even as late as last week. So, but I really appreciate the board's time, too. This has been a long discussion, and finding the right consensus solution has been a lot of work. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Wow, it's noon. I think we covered our agenda, so we will recess and reconvene at 1 p.m.
Great.
I don't want to talk to you.
It's an incredible facility.
Good afternoon.
Keep a little more loyal.
I'd like to call the afternoon session of the December 18th, 2017 Chelan Public Utility District meeting to order. We met this morning in study session, and this afternoon we'll have our business session. But with my fellow commissioners' permission, I'd like to make a slight adjustment to our agenda at the very beginning. We have a member of the public here, Stan Dono. Is that how you pronounce it, Stan? Would like to make a few comments to us. And Stan, our protocol here at the utility is if you come up to the table, there's a microphone right there. If you could give your name and address for the record and just share with us what you would like to say.
I'm Stanley Dono. I live at 1550 Cherry Street, an old folks' home, Columbia Heights. And I wanted to come down and thank you. I don't know if anybody does or not, for Lincoln Rock Park. I'm a rower, and so I'm up there. I was up there the other day when the sun was shining, and I might be there before coming to the meeting. I might be there this afternoon, but I use it a lot, and I appreciate it very much, and it's the greatest thing. I talk to people during the summer that are there, because I'm usually almost at dawn, because I want calm water. But a lot of people really enjoy that park, and I don't really realize it's just a marvelous thing for the community. And I appreciate it all for you. And so I appreciate it. That's all I wanted to.
Well, thank you very, very
thank
much.
You. Very
take
nice.
Time
thank you.
Nice. Thanks.
Right. Great feedback. Thank you.
That's all of us today, these days. And yeah. We're all older guys and gals.
Stanley, you're welcome anytime.
Yeah. And Stan, before you leave, there's a couple gentlemen here from the Parks Department that really timed this well to hear that comment. So those two guys right there particularly want to hear that. So.
Yeah.
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 Because I do that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Good
thank
for
you.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay.
Oh, that was
nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, now item 8 on our agenda is Chelan Planet Walk, and I understand Russ Jones is going to be with us, and
Jeff Smith will introduce.
All right.
And good afternoon, commissioners. Good to see you again. With me is Russ Jones, representing the Lake Chelan Rotary Club. Russ and the club have proposed a project for Chelan Riverwalk Park, something they're calling Chelan Planet Walk, and he's going to discuss that. This has been reviewed by our Parks Department through the standard screening form, which I believe that you've all received copies of. We use this for analysis and assessment of the many requests that we get for structural additions and changes to our existing park facilities. And after they completed that that review, they recommend denial of the proposal and the application of the project. So as the process that we have here, Russ is here to appeal that decision. He's going to describe, first of all, what it is. Russ.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you today. I like your boardroom. It's a lot nicer than what we have for the fire commission. So I'll have to see what we can do about that. The idea of a planet walk is an opportunity for people to get a better understanding of the basics of our solar system and to get some idea of the scale of the world, the universe that we live in. One of the kind of mind-blowing things about this project is it's scaled to encompass planets over about a mile and a half distance. If we were going to include the next closest star to our star, Proxima Centauri, we'd have to put that in the Ukraine. I have no idea how the next closest galaxy would be. Quite a way. It's difficult for human beings to understand just how big and how vast things are. But one of the things to consider is that our grandchildren are very likely going to have a shot at going to space. That's coming up in the future. So the more our kids can understand today about what's up there, the better off they'll be in the future. These have been done in a variety of communities. One in Anchorage, Alaska is set to the equivalent of light speed. So if it takes you 8 minutes to walk from the sun to the station for Earth, it's because it takes 8 minutes for light to travel that far. That one takes about 5 hours to walk the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
Riverwalk Park is an ideal location for this for a variety of reasons. One of the big ones is it's away from traffic for the most part. There are areas where buses could be offloaded or loaded at either end. It's all wheelchair accessible. And it's a reasonable distance. It's linear, so it's easier to capture the concept. This project would be funded by Rotary. The Schlan Club has already allocated $10,000, and we are extremely confident of a matching grant from the Rotary District. We expect the initial cost of the project to be about $14,000, and we'd have monies set aside for ongoing maintenance and graffiti repair and so forth. I guess I would have to ask how many people in the room could name all of the planets in order.
Ooh. I can do that.
Yeah. In order? Yeah. So it's start Mercury, Mars, Earth. Is that the first three?
No, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune.
Wow. Yep. What? Neptune's after Uranus?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So I have a crazy little trick to doing that I've carried forward from grade school, and it goes, what my very educated mother just served us at the time, I think it was 9 pizza pies.
We had food on at that time.
Yeah. So
that's really impressive. Thank
I bet you don't forget it.
Yeah. That was actually an interview question for when I got hired. But
Russ, it might be useful for the board to describe the instruction they've got this.
So there's a diagram of what the proposed stations would look like. This is an aluminum frame with a product called e-board, which is plastic sandwiched between layers of aluminum. The graphics are vinyl, with the addition of, we have a member that can do sublimation printing on aluminum. So we'll actually have some recent NASA photographs of the objects on these stations, which will be kind of cool. This particular product was constructed in St. Louis. We have the rights to use that design, but we'll be modifying it quite a bit. And then also in there is a map of where the stations might be located to give you some idea of, and I actually have a better one with me if you'd like to see it that gets everything on one page. But essentially, it runs from the old bridge in Chelan to and past the parking lot at the Gorge Trail. I understand the process came up with a number of objections to the project, and they're really, I guess, I'm not real familiar with the process, but there wasn't a lot of opportunity to discuss ways of mitigating things. Nothing's set in stone on this project. As far as layout, what the stations even look like, I've thought of various things of ways that could be done differently that might offset some of the concerns that were there. But the bottom line remains that there might be other places to do this, but in Chelan, just about every other place would involve highways. And that means a lot of traffic and also means dealing with Department of Transportation. So Riverwalk is really the number one choice for us to do this project.
So just for the board's benefit, I can outline some of the staff concerns. The president, number one, the current park signage is limited to safety directional and trail etiquette. Visual, Riverwalk Park, as you know, is a confined public space, very small area that could easily become cluttered with signage, and the concern of the president, if you allow this project, what do you open the door to in the long term? Safety, concern that the signs could become obstacles for bicyclists, runners, and walkers using the narrow parkway, again, without the benefit of talking about mitigation alternatives. Increased maintenance, signs will require changes in mowing and edging and dealing with vandalism. We've had vandalism in that park in the past. Signs could be targeted for damage and concern with, despite the good intentions of the group right now, concern that over a long period of time, the upkeep could fall on the PUD. So those were the basic concerns outlined in that report. And anything to add to that?
The issue of opening it up to, you know, if you do this for one, you have to do it for another. And I guess as a banker, if I give one person a loan, doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to give everyone that same loan. There's criteria that are involved in making that determination. As far as the long-term care of the project, probably a possible way to help mitigate that is if we set aside funds for the cost of removal of the project. If for some reason the organization no longer wants to maintain it. Safety issues can be mitigated by having the stations offset from the trail. That was always kind of the intent. It wasn't going to be right next to the paved trail. It would be back several feet. Site congestion, you know, maybe we lay it out differently. Part of it is having the signs lined so that their faces are parallel to the trail, so you're seeing them edge on as you're approaching, would help reduce the site congestion. What else did we have?
Let's see, we had the precedent, the visual, the safety, increased maintenance, vandalism.
Our design with this, and again, there are other ways we could design this, but this particular product has an additional top coat on it that is designed to make it easier to remove graffiti. The vinyls themselves are not very expensive to reproduce if we need to completely remove one and replace the vinyls.
Commissioner Congdon.
Well, I know Russ. I've known Russ for a long time. Usually I'm on the same side as Russ of an issue. When I'm not on the same side, I worry because Russ gets things done. So I have a tremendous amount of faith. And when Russ says this is something that Rotary will take on and will stay with and complete and support, I believe it. In fact, Russ started the Sailing Association in Chelan how many years ago?
That was in 2000.
Still going strong. There are a number of other things Russ has done, and he is very reliable, and he'll stick with it, as is the Rotary. The Rotary in Chelan is very active. They have supported a number of different projects, and when they take something on, they carry it through to the end and support it. So I have no worry there. And then the last thing I'm going to say is I'm not one for worrying about precedent. If we always worried about setting a precedent, we would never get anything done. And I believe if it's a really worthwhile project, that something that we all like and there's value to it, educational value, I'm not going to worry about precedent so much.
Commissioner Bowles.
Yeah, regarding precedents, remember back, at least when three of us were pretty early in our commissions, the decision to name the park after Kirby Billingsley, and we were told at that time that you can't open that can of worms because everyone will want everything named after someone. And I remember the comment at the time was that if anyone else rises to the level of Kirby Billingsley, we should be obligated to name a park after him. So I'm not sure that precedence is always the best way to go. I do have some concerns about, additional work for our maintenance crews. And I guess, Russ, what interested me too in what you said is that to have a portion of the fund set aside, that because I've seen it and we've all seen it in communities where somebody had a great idea and it lasted for a while and then it just slowly deteriorated and became ugly. And I don't think that should be the PUD's decision to remove that or the PUD's finances to cause that to happen. And so Rotary, by and large, is notorious for staying with what they say they're going to do. And if you're willing to set the funds aside, that at least eases some of my thinking, regarding, this project. And I know that the good people of Chelan do not want to have essentially portable billboards for graffiti. And so community pride will, take care of that. We would just like you to do it rather than us. And, if that doesn't happen, I think this commission is probably strong enough to say to Chelan Rotary, you're not holding up your end of the deal. Either fix it or remove it. And we know you have a fund to remove it. But I also, in my heart of hearts, still that educator. And to be able to take, my youngest granddaughter along that trail and point those out would be a really good afternoon.
And you probably will have more than one grandchild that you take along then.
Well, yeah, I've got one that's close. And she would like that. I've got one that would be offended by that long of a walk.
Commissioner Arsenault.
Roughly how, give me the size of the sign. Is it 20 inches wide? Is that what I'm seeing?
Yeah, about 20 inches high. In this particular design, the top would be at about 7 feet. Again, all kinds of flexibility. The interesting thing about this design is the yellow half circle that you see up there represents the sun, and then I think you have the Jupiter sign there. There's a white dot at the bottom of that yellow that represents the relative size of Jupiter, still in the same scale of the model overall. But the signs can be smaller or bigger or whatever we want to do.
And the next question I have, Jeff, is for you. In terms of this being a problem for the maintenance crews, is it because of mowing the lawn, or where would the problem be?
I'm going to bring Mr. Baker up here and ask him to address that, our parks manager.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Commission. Ryan Baker and parks manager. To address your question, yeah, anything we put in the park, be it a tree or a post, is dealt with, what I would say, on a weekly basis as far as needing to trim around or to weed eat around. So we're very careful about where we place things and where exactly they are. I hope that answers your question.
So could this be placed in a way that would minimize the inconvenience of having to go around with a mower?
Good question. I think we need to walk the site and really make sure that it fits with the distances that I believe he's describing, depending on exactly where those locations are. Certainly there are things that we could do to minimize that.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
You bet.
I'd like to just, if I can, carry on the conversation and echo what Commissioner Congdon said. I've known Russ for a very, very long time. We've worked together a couple of different times. And I also know him to be a gentleman who not only gets things done, but is true to his word. Mm-hmm. Hearing Russ give me assurances that both he and the Rotary, which I've also had some contact and some dealings with the Chelan Rotary, and I know them also to be very true to their word, leads me to feel supportive of this project. But I would like to also echo what Commissioner Bolt said, and that is that having the money set aside in a reserve for the eventual removal of each of these makes sense for, I think, both for Rotary, knowing that the money's there, but also for us then as the PUD to know that we weren't going to be straddled with this project to have to remove it. So I just wanted to share that with you.
So, Russ, we've met, I think. I've been up at Lakeshoreland Rotary a couple of times, but my comments will be made as a 30-year Rotarian from Kashmir. And I've already worked over Jeff a little bit this morning. On
literally.
I would love to see this project succeed. I absolutely would. And I think there's some really good comments that have been made here about mitigation for the issues that have been brought forward. But one of the things that I don't want to have lost on this commission is I had a long conversation with your club president, Les Cooper, a month or two ago about this project in particular. And the fact what Chelan Rotary is doing right now in the community of Chelan, making a commitment to 10 projects of this nature over the next 10 years in celebration of their 100th birthday. And so, I mean, the longevity and the concern about what this project will look like 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road is, in my estimation, the least of my worries. And I have a high degree of faith and confidence and support for what Rotary does for the community. And so, you know, I'd like to see us do what we can to make this work. I know you're not asking us for any action today on anything, but
well, there's a pretty clear consensus.
I guess one of the things that'd be really important, though, is to have the Rotarians with our staff get together and find the best solutions we can to the concerns that have been raised. And I know this can come across to staff as an undermining moment, but in a way it's a supporting moment in terms of, you know, our parks are great, and we want to protect them. And so if we do something in them, we want it done right, and that requires the input of our staff and their leadership. So if we can work that out, I would. And people keep playing accolades. I don't think you ever cheated on a test, did you?
I have no recollection.
Yeah, this is a democratic process. The board, the staff made a very objective decision. The board is here as the ruling body to make a determination, and there are no hard feelings at all. So I checked with general counsel, and we would govern this with a permit agreement, which we can work on, including defining what kind of mitigation, what kind of locations are going to be considered as well. So we have no heartburn with that. Steve, do you have a question?
Just maybe coming at it a little differently. you know, as a school principal and superintendent, I always get a little worried, good intentions intact, of what things are going to look like. In other words, I've seen a lot of buildings that look like a mortuary outside. There's plaques to everybody who's passed away, and it's all great, but after a while, the appearance is concerning, and not that educational signs look like tombstones, but, you know, I guess the look is what gives me a little bit of concern. I love the educational value. I appreciate the idea of talking about mitigating and working with our staff on safety and maintenance issues. But I guess my question is kind of an overall community value question, Russ, that maybe you can help answer. Again, it's going back to good intentions, educating. I mean, nobody's arguing those type of things. But or questioning Rotary, you know, as a past Rotarian, I have to admit I'm a little biased for Rotarian projects and educational things. I mean, those all pull at my value strings. But has your group done anything, and I'll just blunder into this question because I'm not sure I really know what I'm asking. Has there been any survey done in the community that gives you or your group any information? I mean, your group may be excited about this, but overall in the community, would people be supportive or concerned with the appearance of the and you know, whether it was a survey, kind of a not Russ doing the survey and, you know, getting information from all your friends, but I think even as a Rotarian, I would want to know, does our community want signage in the parks? I think I'd want to know that. Have you done anything like that? Or
other than talking with people informally about it, usually it's getting past the glazed look after I do the initial explanation of the project. But everyone I've talked to has been pretty enthusiastic about it. They say, oh, I walked down there. This will be neat to see. Our trails group is endorsing it. It's endorsed by Schlan Manson and the Rondo School Districts. But as far as a formal poll, have not done anything like that. We could get on KOZI and describe the project and invite anyone that has objections to let me know. Because frankly, the more input we get on the project, the better it'll be. So I don't know that. Well, I suppose we could do a Survey Monkey type.
I'm not sure I'm really asking for that, but I guess I'm not sure what I'm asking for, but I guess just due diligence in the community that from your group that people would like to see this, not get it put up and then have people howling that what in the world are we putting more signs in the park for?
Understand.
The trails group you just mentioned, what I'm not familiar with them. How big a group is that in Chelan?
It's relatively small. I mean, we're working with them on the what was the trail that Elephant's Head has now been redesignated as an extension of Reach 1. Mm-hmm. That's Guy Evans and his group, very active in planning trails in the Lake Chelan area.
Seems like that would be a pretty key group. If they're, you know, showing some support. That's a good beginning for exactly what you were asking about, it seems to me.
I was wondering if, Russ was talking about the idea of you going on with Jay in the morning on KOZI and then using Go Lake Chelan as a means for being able to check and see what people think. And we could provide that information back to the board.
Yeah, I think that could be.
Okay.
Something that could be set up.
Yeah. That'd be something, Commissioner, that you think you'd support? Okay.
I was just going to add that Russ mentioned that when you mention this to people, and I've actually asked people about it too after we talked, and you get a glazed look. And I think that's because many people, don't understand astronomy. I mean, they had a little bit of it in school, but if you don't have a model that sees how things move relative to each other, or if you don't, you know, the fact, I just think this is a cool project, the fact that it's scaled, you know, But unless you're, you know, in the middle of it and interacting and walking it and seeing the relative sizes and say these two are this far apart and it's this many steps and these two are this far apart, I mean, people love that. They like interactive, engaged kind of learning, not sitting in the classroom reading out of a textbook. We don't do enough of this kind of thing. So, I mean, I'm obviously a supporter. Thank you for doing that.
I mentioned to Gary earlier that I read an article recently that human beings can't understand infinity. We just really can't grasp it. And it's because that was never necessary for our survival. So the human brain just never developed the ability to do that. And I read that and I thought, yeah, that kind of makes sense. So this is something that helps form a better understanding of what's out there.
Commissioner, would you like to give us some direction? No decision, just...
Well, I think you have it.
Okay, consensus?
I think you do.
Okay. So, Russ, would you commit then to KOZI and Glacial Land?
Absolutely.
All right. And we can get our communications group in touch with you to coordinate the information. We'll bring it back to the board and share it. And once we've done that, again, we develop a permit agreement between the club and the PUD for how we'll do this, okay, assuming that the results come back supportive. Okay? Yeah. See, nods. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
As long as the concrete that it's embedded in isn't too big, if they had to be removed, the fund wouldn't have to be that big probably for removal.
No.
Good point. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks, Russ.
Thank you. Commissioners, our consent agenda is next. And if you remember, we modified it this morning to include resolutions 13 and 15.
I move approval of the consent agenda as modified.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Resolution number 11.
Thank you, Commissioner. So we'll start with a resolution declaring Alcatel-Lucent USA, Inc. as the continuing sole source of certain fiber to the premise equipment, waiving the competitive negotiation process established by RCW 39.04.270, approving additional expenditures, and authorizing the district to extend the district's existing contract for the purchase of said equipment and support services. And we're welcoming up Bob Shane.
Thank you. Bob Shane, Director of Fiber and Telecom. Good afternoon, Commissioners. If you recall, I was here at the last board meeting and gave you an overview of what this contract was all about. If you would allow me a couple of seconds here, and I'll quickly go back over that and give you some highlights and answer any questions you may have. So this is to continue the sole source declaration of the Nokia Alcatel solutions and products. It's to extend the contract to lock in favorable terms and an anticipated discount, and I'll cover that in a little bit more detail, adding $9.12 million to the existing contract for equipment and services. The Nokia, the Alcatel solution, has proven to be a product performance with excellent business and technical support. Any alternative to that solution would require significant investment in logistics to be able to maintain and operate. And so it continues to bring enhanced value to our customers through a standardized solution. Again, we have favorable pricing and payment terms under the existing contract. So in a quick summary, we're looking to request board declaration of the continued sole source, request board approval of the resolution to extend the contract to preserve the favorable terms and conditions that I basically highlighted, add funds of $9.12 million to the Alcatel contract with revised amount not to exceed $37,995,000. And this includes a discount amount of approximately $550,000 that's going to be realized over the term of the contract extension. Any questions?
Bob, as a new commissioner, can you explain to me the discount that you just spoke about?
Absolutely. We went and approached Alcatel and asked them if we did a extended purchase of support services, if they'd give us a additional discount in a five-year commitment versus an annual commitment. And through that negotiations, they reduced the overall price down by $550,000 over if you did it annually for the same time period. That's primarily for services, which are support contracts for maintaining the system.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is Resolution 12, authorizing amendment number 1 for additional funds to services agreement SA number 17-002 with Superior Consulting, Inc. of Walla Walla, Washington for management consulting services. And Kirk Hudson is here to present.
Good afternoon. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. I am representing a number of business units today that use this service agreement. This resolution is proposing an amendment to an existing service agreement, 17-002, with Sapir from Walla Walla, Washington. They also have offices in Spokane, Seattle, and they do have an office in Wenatchee that used to have one person in it that we since hired as a district employee. They still have the office here, but there's not anybody currently in it. The district entered into this service agreement in January of last year for management consulting services in support of generation and transmission, external affairs, natural resources, and the public power benefit project associated with hydro research. The agreement was for $1,190,000 over a three-year period. We're planning to add additional projects that were recently approved in the 2018 budget, just at the last board meeting, to the scope of this agreement. That would be assisting us in putting our data analytics platform together for our hydro facilities, continued work on Kaplan pipe failure analysis of B9 at Rock Island Powerhouse 1, and project management for our decentralized operations activities in preparation for termination of hourly coordination, as well as support for external affairs, natural resources, and Rock Island relicensing planning support. Sapir has a proven track record in supporting the district's efforts and projects, and their unique blend of technical expertise, innovative thinking, system thinking experience in the utility industry, respected leadership and project management with the district makes them the most qualified firm to do this work. I might add that they do follow the same project management process we do, using the Project Management Institute process. And so they follow in sync with every phase of the project that we perform here, and their documents support our workflow process and project management. This amendment proposes adding $1,360,000 to the service agreement, keeping the same three-year term that was established last January 2017 for a new not-to-exceed amount of $2,550,000. The project work that they will be doing will be managed by individual task authorizations with discrete scope, schedule, and budget, and in some cases even phases. So there'll be specific agreements on each of the particular activities they would be doing with those conditions. With that, I'll open it up to any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is Resolution 14, authorizing Amendment Number 3 to Services Agreement Task Authorization, SA Number 15-030, with Nash Consulting, Inc., to provide leadership and management consulting and training services, and Jeremy Jordan will present.
Hi, Commissioners. As you know, one of our largest programs for reinvesting in our people in the last couple of years has been this partnership with Nash Consulting and our Leadership Excellence Series. And so this resolution really is about not only continuing that partnership, but expanding it in some ways with an exciting new program that we've designed for our leadership team. For anybody who isn't aware of kind of how that program works, in 2015, we started a partnership with Mike to offer our Leadership Excellence Series to our entire leadership team across the district. And that is a four-day workshop that focuses on 15 different leadership skills that Mike has based on a ton of research. And so in addition to that, Mike has offered a ton of consulting services to our management team, both for new leaders and for different issues that pop up both in our crafts and our non-crafts workforce. And so he's been a really valuable resource there. What we've asked Mike to help us expand in 2018, we actually piloted this year with a limited group, and that is the idea of saying, now that you have these leadership skills, how do you grow in them and how do you apply them as leaders? And so our pilot this year focused on individual coaching, taking the model of executive coaching that a lot of senior leaders use around the business world, and saying, as a leader here at the district, we're going to give you a time bank of 5 hours that you get to use with a coach and work on both your strengths and your weaknesses as a leader. And that's based on a 360-degree review that these people do with their own teams. In addition, this pilot has a built-in bank for these teams to work together. Again, bringing in one of Mike's consultants to work together on their issues on a larger group. And so this resolution really is about not only continuing our relationship, expanding the amount allowed to $698 for the next 2 years, but then also allowing this program to go forward, this coaching model that is pretty innovative in the Utilities District. We're going to be the first, really, organization to do this, and Mike believes that it's going to be something that could potentially impact not just the organization, but a lot of different ones around the Northwest. So some of the specifics, so the resolution asks for $185,000 a year for this leadership excellence training for the next 2 years. We're also budgeting $50,000 a year for, again, those consultative opportunities that Mike has to come in with both new and existing leaders and work with their teams on whatever issues they have. And then we've got a small buffer in the hopes that this becomes really popular and gives us some opportunities that we didn't budget for. So we'll open it for any questions.
Questions?
Who's your leadership team? I should know, but I don't remember who's on the leadership team.
Okay, so that's basically any manager, any supervisor, and then a large swath of our program managers, people that don't necessarily have anybody reporting to them, but have kind of a program that they're responsible for district-wide that's strategic in nature. So there's about 95 people on that right now.
So this initially was to provide leadership and management consulting and training in the amount not to exceed $48,000. I'm just kind of getting caught up here. And then you added $100,000 to the agreement, and then you add another $50,000. And this just seems like a big jump to add an additional $500,000 for a total for the next 2 years, $698,000.
It's a great observation. So we originally started with a really small scope with Mike. It was just offering the training. And that's a four-day training, costs about $3,500 a day. Mm-hmm. And so I think we did three sets of those, and that didn't even get close to using up the $48,000 we originally thought. What really quickly happened then is people saw the value in this leadership stuff that Mike was doing and called them in for these group trainings or interventions in different cases. And then building on top of that, this coaching model, it's going to be a lot more expensive potentially, but we also think that it's going to have a lot more impact. This idea of saying, okay, I'm a senior manager at the district. I've got three or four different weaknesses and a whole bunch of strengths that impact dozens of my employees. Let's sit down with an expert and figure out how I can move in those in a really proactive way and see the impact on the group that I manage. So it's really about time is the major cost for Mike's team. This is going to represent, you know, instead of just a couple days, potentially hundreds of hours for his team to come in and work both one-on-one and with small groups across the district. Right now we have 56 people, leaders who have volunteered for this program next year, and then 35 separate teams who are all interested in getting this work. And so that's where the major investment comes from.
So you've seen some impact. You've seen some good positive results so far.
I think just about every intervention that Mike has had, people have said, wow, not only did we get exactly what we were looking for, but he surprised us with the way that we really were able to build relationships with our team. One of the big examples is that he's worked with our foreman in the crafts to come up with agreements between supervisors and foremen and say, what does each group need from each other? And what are the specific plans we have going forward to make sure that we meet those needs together? And so Mike helped those teams both kind of figure out what their issues were and then craft a really formal document that many of them are now using to kind of manage their relationships.
Well, that's important.
For sure.
To touch the foreman and hear from them.
Exactly.
Because we often don't with leadership training, I don't think. Well, that's good.
To kind of share with you some of the impact that's being recognized in the industry, based on his experience with us, Mike is actually expanding to a number of PUDs around Washington and using us as kind of a case study to say, here's the impact that what I'm doing can have on the utility industry specifically. And I've been contacted by probably a half dozen different utilities in the last 3 or 4 months just saying, hey, it sounds like you guys are doing some really cool things. Can we get in on that? Hmm. So kind of an exciting point that we're really kind of helping not only just impact our own leadership, but we're expanding to help kind of set the stage for a lot of different utilities around Washington.
Gary.
Is there any way possible for you to boil this down for me just to come to a cost per employee, or let's put it another way, a benefit per employee for this training?
Sure. So for an individual who's participating next year, hourly cost with Nash Consulting is $350 an hour. And we're proposing a time bank of 5 hours per person who's going to participate. And then on top of that, if you're a manager who has direct reports and you opt in, you get also a time bank of 4 hours for your team to do like a half-day training or however they want to use that time. So that's 9 hours basically per person at $350 an hour. And to give you a kind of a rule of thumb on that cost, so a full day of Mike's time is about $3,500. And for some of the trainings that we've done, large group trainings here at the district in the last 2 years that I've been involved in, it's not uncommon to have $6,000 to $12,000 be a day cost. So believe it or not, Mike is actually pretty economical in what he charges us for the time that he spends. I think the highest I've seen for a two-day training so far has been around $26,000. So.
Wow. Thank you.
Yep.
I was just going to add that I think that you could compare that to something like the Center for Creative Leadership or Blue Point training. And this is Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources, Labor and Safety. And sending employees to those trainings one by one by one is very expensive, minimum of $10,000 of tuition, and then flying them there, their expenses to stay for a week. So this is really very, I think, cost-effective and efficient. People stay here at work. They really get to apply it immediately, and we really see the benefits quite quickly.
Thank you, Lorna, for coming forward. And my mind was thinking of this is it's a benefit as any other benefit that we provide for the employees. And so it would be nice to capture that when we talk and have conversations with prospective employees that we can say, well, you know, these are the types of benefits that we can provide here at the district and the values that we walk the walk and talk the talk in terms of investing in our employees. So
it's a great idea.
Yeah. Thank you.
Additional questions?
Thank you.
Great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our final resolution for this afternoon is item 16, a resolution restating and revising policies and delegating authority regarding procurement and contracting and rescinding and replacing resolution number 08-13325 and other inconsistent resolutions. And Eric? It's to you.
Thanks, Commissioners. So we already talked about this morning. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. Okay.
Oh, Commissioner. How many other inconsistent resolutions are there?
None that I'm able to identify, which is why it's listed as other inconsistent resolutions instead of called out specifically. So from time to time, we find little bits and pieces of things as we review resolutions historically. Usually that bubbles up as an event or a situation develops and somebody in a stack of papers pulls something out from his or her office and we have to address it. So that is general language intended only to give us guidance that this is the last final word, most recent final word, as to the topics that it addresses. Where it is not intended to rescind or revoke other resolutions, such as the small works resolution that was recently adopted here by the board and restated, this resolution says so.
You raised another question in my mind when
oh,
you were
darn
asking
it.
That one. How long till we get all our resolutions digitized?
So all of our resolutions are stored and they are in FileNet and available and we can search and find them.
Okay.
So they are all in existence.
All right. That works.
I don't have a three-ring binder of them in my office, if that's your point.
Yeah.
Karen takes care of managing all of those and they are on FileNet and are searchable. Okay. So actually they should still be on the, intra and intranet. I believe is the case.
But ultimately, do we still have hard copies in the vault somewhere?
We do.
Yeah. That's important, too.
Yep.
Any other questions? Commissioners, we've got resolutions 11, 12, 14, and 16 to consider. We can take them all together or individually or any package that you desire. What is the desire of the commission?
Mr. President, I move that we accept resolutions 11, 12, 14, and 16 as presented.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried unanimously. All right, manager items.
So we do have a few today. And first we'll start with an update on the shoreline management plan discussions with the county. And Eric Walclose is going to give us that update.
Thanks, Kelly. Commissioners, just wanted to say thank you for your efforts with the Chelan County and those of you who showed up and those who provided email support and input. Those of you that were there probably have already reported to those who could not make it that it was, I think, a successful meeting. There were some nice comments from all of the attendees, the county commissioners, certainly our commissioners, and the Wades who were there. I have taken it as my responsibility to set the next planning meeting, given the commitment that was made by our commission to work to develop a better, more formalized stakeholder outreach process. So I'm setting up meetings after Christmas to get that process started. And my intent is to check in with you from time to time. I can't give you my roadmap or my timeline yet because I don't think it's mine to establish. We'll have to do that. I'm in conjunction with staff, internal resources, and then community participation, but I'll keep you appraised of that, and just my thanks.
Any comments? I would share one comment. A few days after that meeting, I had occasion to be in a meeting with Mike Caputa and asked him, you know, how he felt about the meeting. He said, I didn't understand what happened.
No comment.
That's what I said. I mean, he was thrilled. I think he was very happy.
You mean start to finish?
What?
He didn't understand what happened. You mean start to finish?
At the meeting.
Oh, at the meeting.
How? So for clarity, so there's no misunderstanding. The county commissioners, and it's been confirmed by staff at the county with Lilith, that the language that we have been speaking about with respect to utilities in the riparian areas near the shorelines has been restored to the language that was approved and submitted to the county commissioners by the county planning commission. So we're back to full circle.
Yep. Yep. Well, I thank my fellow commissioners for taking the time and effort to be there and the comments that were made. And I've shared with, I think, all my fellow commissioners, I think Eric's efforts on behalf of the district were absolutely tremendous to create the understanding of the impact of various policies for all of us. So I want to thank Eric a lot.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think the work's just getting started in some respects. So more to follow.
All right. Other manager items.
Next, I'd like to invite up Andrew Grissell to give us an update on the LED streetlight rate information meetings.
Short. I've held two meetings so far. They've been in both Leavenworth and the city of Chelan. Leavenworth on December 11th, Chelan on December 12th. And little report, there were no attendees to show up. And so it's not unexpected considering that it's for municipals. It's not something to impact individual customers. And we've been already speaking with the individual cities and county for a long period of time. And so it's not too unexpected. There's one more meeting scheduled, and it's the 20th, and it's down at the CTC building. So,
okay. And I wasn't paying attention, but the reminder that the public hearing's on the 8th,
yes. Right? Public hearing will be on the 8th. Yep.
Thank you, Andrew. Next, I'd like to invite up Mario Cantu, and he's going to tell us about Fiesta Decembrina.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Good afternoon, everyone. Mario Cantu, External Affairs.
And I guess I'll go ahead and pass just some printouts on that. So the second annual Fiesta Decembrina that Chelan PUD is hosting is will be taking place in at the Leavenworth office. And last year, we had a pretty good turnout showed up to our headquarters building. We hosted the event at the auditorium, and it was very successful. We had over 250 people showed up in a two-hour period, in and out. We set up a resource table to communicate important information to our customer owner base. So this year, we faced a challenge, yet an opportunity. We don't longer have an auditorium. However, we do have other facilities that we can take advantage of. So in partnership with the radio station, we have we made the decision to move the event to the Leavenworth office. And this is turning out to be quite a nice put-together event with collaboration of many work units, parks, external affairs, communications, fiber, security, office services. Office staff for the Leavenworth office. It's really nice to see the different work units come together and work for the same goal, which is providing customer information with relevant information. So we're talking about safety messages, so down power lines. We're also talking about how to do some preventive work to our water customers. So when it's cold out, don't get frozen out. And some of the key points that you could do at home to make sure that you take initiative to prevent from a situation happening. We're talking about our new park application, so 2018 day pass parking day. You know what I'm talking about. Sorry, my dyslexia and English and Spanish brain are kind of mixed all together. But we're also talking about Stay Connected, which is a one-page document we have created that talks about English and Spanish. That talks about how to stay connected with Chelan PUD and what to do if you're facing outages, if you have questions about your account, your bill. About Fiverr. We have worked pretty closely with Fiverr. Fiverr will be at the event with an actual live computer so we can check and verify addresses for Fiverr connections. So it's a nice feature. We also did invite our partner, Upper Valley Med, a nonprofit agency that works with at promise or at risk families. So they also were invited to be there and provide some valuable information and hopes to connect folks with resources. So I hope that tells you what you were hoping to hear, and open it for questions if you have any. But just a really tremendous effort from different work units, power collaboration across the district, and just the willingness to support this kind of initiatives across the board is pretty amazing. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think, you know, Mario, maybe just a comment. Recently, a generous person in the community sponsors the cops shops with kids. Mm. And out of that were a couple of pieces of information. I think one that really stuck with me is one of the 7.5-year-old boys couldn't be there. And the reason why is that the family was living in a home that the landlord sold. The new owners did the eviction. They literally moved into a shed, which got burnt down because they used a long extension cord, just not knowing that would be a resistor over time. Moved into another neighbor's shed with her permission, did the same thing again. Moved to a third one, and when public services went to find out why the 7.5-year boy had missed his chance to shop, found him at 4 o'clock in the afternoon alone in that shed because both parents were still working. And so I guess what I'm getting at is that we need to be in the business to continue to provide information to families about their health and safety and access and
thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, and so please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Appreciate the feedback.
Thank you.
And we just have two more short items. Eric's going to update us on an interlocal agreement with the PUD and the port.
Thanks, Commissioners. This really should be
Andrew, who's here as well, and it's creditor blame to him. So I'm teasing. I asked him to be here. I think he missed our prep meeting this morning or wasn't invited, and I got saddled with this, so he's here to back me up. So the at the recent Tri-Commission meeting, I think the last one, the one I attended, you heard a little bit from Andrew and Greg Carrington about the effort to partner with the port to look into available properties throughout the county and identify areas that might sustain larger loads in excess of 5 megawatts in particular, which would be a Schedule 4 load for us, and do some infrastructure analysis on what might be required to site some follow-on assets there if we were going to sort of cluster up these types of new loads that were coming in, whether they be high-density loads or other loads. So Andrew actually was leading that effort for the PUD and giving you just an update that we were able to successfully, due to Andrew's efforts, enter into a small up to $25,000 commitment interlocal agreement with the port to take advantage of an already existing consulting contract they had with Burke Consulting to expand the scope of that contract to include a preliminary report on this particular effort. And so we're going to take advantage of the work that the port already had started and have committed to pay up to $25,000 of district money in order to develop a report that would be valuable to the effort that was described to you at the Tri-Commission meeting. And then probably from there evaluate next steps. And I should, in fairness, ask Andrew, is there anything you'd like to add to that, Andrew? Okay, so any questions about that? Andrew's here. So I would tell you that under our current delegation resolution, the reason this was already entered is it does not require board approval for this nature of interlocal. That's why we're reporting it to you after it has been signed, and it is also something that won't be required for board approval under the new delegation resolution.
Thank you, Eric. And then to finish, I'd like to invite up Jeff Smith to talk about water quality support letter.
Commissioners, Jeff Smith, Managing Director, District Services. During the December 13 meeting of the Lake Chelan Watershed Planning Unit, there was an announcement by Mike Caputa that the county plans to seek grant funding to support water quality work at the lake. He was asking for letters of support amongst those entities that were at the meeting. District staff is supportive of that request. In fact, drafted the original that you've seen circulated in the last couple of days, and would propose that we endorse that. The way it's set up right now is the board president, Commissioner Smith, would be the one signing on behalf of the board. And Marcy Clement and Jeff Osborne were at the meeting. If you have any questions for them.
I just have a comment. I appreciate bringing this forward. I hope we can support through a letter. I've talked about Phil Long and the work he's doing with the Lake Chelan Research Institute, and he's doing a fabulous job. It's amazing to have a research scientist retire in your community and go to work on something. So he's doing terrific things. And you know, I had suggested and was hopeful that maybe the PUD could offer some further kind of support, but there seems to be some issues with the water quality language. And so anyway, just the letter of support does not obligate us financially in any way. It's just, you know, it's just a supportive letter saying we like what you're doing and we support you.
And there actually is new information on supporting the Institute. Marcy, would you like to come up and explain that agreement you're working on?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Yes, we have put aside $5,000 to contribute to the county's quality assurance project plan. I'm working on that right now with Deb Bryant and Katie Yant. And so it's the existing agreement we have with the county. We have a master agreement. And this is just an additional item where we would provide $5,000 for the county to revise their QAP that they have right now. That's the quality assurance project plan.
Thank you.
Yes. You lost me for a second.
Yeah. That's an ecology and EPA requirement for how you collect your data so that it's credible data. And so our team, Jeff Osborne, myself, Michelle Smith and Jeff, and we met with Steve Wright and talked about what would be value for the district. Although we're not required to do water quality monitoring, we would be interested. So we thought that would be a great way to capture that interest.
Fantastic.
So I'm working on that. Mike Caputa said that he didn't need that until 2018. Really close to having the letter done. I've got to pitch it back to Mike for him to comment on it. So that's where we're at with that.
Wow, thank you. I know that the city of Chelan is donating $20,000 yearly. Port is allocating $5,000 to $10,000. Every entity is donating money. So I was hoping there was something that we could.
I believe Manson
kind of
and Chelan
help.
School districts both are contributing.
Yeah, they are. They are. So yeah, I was just hopeful we could help somehow. So that's great.
Thank you, Marcy.
Thank you.
So, commissioners, up to you on the letter. Again, that's a separate issue from the funding that we're providing through what Marcy's working on.
You need a nod of the heads.
That would be great.
I think, yeah.
Yep. I see five nods. Thank you. And, Rebecca, you have the original. Is that correct? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. And that's all.
All right. Commission items. We have one specified that doesn't limit it to the one item, but I did ask that the election of 2018 officers be on the agenda for today. So simplify our transition for our next meeting, which will be January 8th, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioners, what is your desire in terms of officers, slate or individually, or how would we like to handle this?
Well, I'll just jump right in and say that I would move to nominate a slate of officers. And that slate is composed of Dennis Bowles for president, Gary Arsenault vice president, and Steve McKenna secretary for the 2018 year.
Motion's been put on the table. Is there a second?
It's like, wait a minute. Here's an awkward moment.
I second.
Motion dies for lack of a second.
Wait.
It would be difficult to have a motion die for lack of a second. It's been moved and seconded. We elect a slate of officers for the 2018 year, being Dennis Bowles as president, Gary Arsenault as vice president, and Steve McKenna as secretary. I was going to ask for further nominations, but that'd be tough. So I think if there's no discussion on the motion, I would ask all those in favor to signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. That is our slate of officers for 2018. Are there any other commission items? No.
I just had a question, and I guess I could have asked this of John, but what was the time frame for the old station substation update? Where are we at on that? I just see all the building going on out there.
Yeah, John Solt, Managing Director, Customer Utilities. I would say it's kind of on the same path as the North Shore and Leavenworth, but in some regards maybe a little bit ahead, because taking advantage with Stamilt and their property and their site work that they were conducting as they build their facility, was able to do some of the civil work required and things like the cables coming out, the conduits being put in to the right level and things of that nature. So that's where it's at, but it'll probably follow when we do procure the transformers, the switch gear, the control houses, things of that nature. But it'll be interesting because there's three of them coming at us, on a relatively same time frame. So does that answer that?
Thank you.
Probably it would be 2020 when, it is actually turned on. Maybe 2019 late.
John, just a quick question. The access road to access that substation, I see they've put a ramp in on the back side of that property where all the grading has been done by the river. Is that where the access is that we come down into that?
I'd have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure.
All right. No problem. Just curious.
Thank you. Any other commission items for today?
I'd like to say a few things. I had an opportunity to attend an APPA conference in San Francisco, and it was fascinating. And a couple of morsels that I found particularly interesting. One was that Sacramento Municipal Utility District, SMUD, being interested in transportation as a major polluter and very significantly focused on carbon reduction, was looking at ways in their conservation plan that they could address the issue of transportation besides just putting in chargers. And they worked with a local Nissan dealership who had an oversupply of Nissan Leafs. And through the conservation department and also Nissan's efforts to reduce the cost of the car, they were able to reduce the car. Now, keep in mind, a Nissan Leaf is about a $30,000 to $35,000 vehicle. So they were able to get Nissan to drop the price with conservation assistance, $10,000 off the MSRP. Combine them with a federal incentive of $7,500 and an additional $2,500 state incentive. So they marked the price down $20,000 on a $30,000 car.
Wow.
And it was tremendously successful. They were able, I think they sold somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 brand new Leafs in a 45-day period. So that conservation program worked. Additionally, one of the things that was brought up was SMUD's interest and discussions that they're having with very large tech companies such as Google, that these tech companies are very focused on carbon-free energy, but even equally important is the reliability of that energy. It was stated that in the mind of a Google exec, 1 second is too much for being without reliable power. So knowing about things like wind that suddenly turns off and sun that goes down, and then looking for a way to bring that reliability standard back up, SMUD is in conversations and selling quite a bit of capacity to the tech companies, which is being seen as quite successful for them. And then one little tidbit that I thought was particularly interesting, we heard from a PhD, Dr. Robert Shanker, who brought back into focus just how long electricity has all been a part of our lives. We talk about electricity as if it's always been here. But the first electric power plant was opened September 4th, 1882, 135 years ago. Prior to 135 years ago, we didn't have electricity. And that was that power plant was started by the brainchild of Thomas Edison, but with the financial backing of J.P. Morgan to get that operational, and it was able to power 45 light bulbs. 45 light bulbs. So power has only been in our lives for 135 years, even though it seems like forever.
Yeah, I think in this state it was around 1886, and it was a steamboat in Elliott Bay that had an internal generator. And it had a string of light bulbs going in each direction, and that was the first live production of electricity in the state, just a couple of years after the Edison one.
We forget. We think it's here, or at least I do. I think this take it for granted. Yeah. So brings it back to reality.
Yeah. Good comments. Good feedback. Any other commission items? Follow up on items from the previous board meeting.
We had two. The first one is Mike Coleman is preparing a historical comparison of the maximum monthly bandwidth usage, and that's still in progress. And then our second one is staff research on options and costs for an opt-in program versus an opt-out option for advanced meters, and that's also still in progress.
Delegation from this meeting.
So thank you, Rebecca. The first one is the Arondo Park survey results, to look at those with Douglas County respondents only. And then also, let's see, to look at potential modifications to Alternative 1, where the PUD covers the O&M costs and then the fees And any funding that the port was able to get could go towards capital improvements. So that will be on the list to look at. And then also to provide information on the costs of irrigation water versus more natural areas, if it was went to a more natural state.
Or where that water comes from, you know. Is that part of it?
Is it permitted?
Does it come from the water district? Is it permitted? Exactly, you know, all the details, if you would, about the water source
and where it comes from.
Thank you.
I added that. Thank you, Commissioner. And then we also have the follow-up that Jeff will lead on working with Chelan Rotary on the looking at the staff concerns around the Chelan Planet Walk and see what solutions can be determined. And that would also include additional community feedback on their desire to have the signage in the park. And then I think the one other one that I think I see also is just confirming Eric's taking the responsibility to set the next planning meetings for customer outreach on the shoreline management plan discussions.
Yep. Are there... For the two of you that weren't at that meeting, that's a really important takeaway from that meeting with the county commissioners. So,
yep. Just so you know. It's the linchpin.
I don't see any public, so I doubt that there's any additional public comment. Any other matters that need to come before us before we move into executive session? How long for an executive session?
Approximately 1 hour.
We'll do it quicker if we can.
Okay. Then, that being said, we right after we take a five-minute break, we will move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by the RCWs, and to consider information regarding the infrastructure and security of computer and telecommunications networks, security and service recovery plans, security risk assessments, and security test results to the extent that they identify specific system vulnerabilities pursuant to the RCWs. So we'll take that'll be a 1 hour executive session following a 5 minute break.
Or short. Or it'll be a very favorable contract.
So we're coming out of executive session. It is about 4 minutes after 3 p.m. No votes were taken. No decisions were made. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.
And I'd like to congratulate my fellow commissioners for picking off the rookie and getting him in the secretarial role.
Yeah.